to know that if the item is not agendized that you're speaking to tonight, the board cannot comment and cannot answer questions, and nor can either any member of our staff. So please understand that that's why we're not responding to you. We also will have a limit on the amount of time that we can devote to this. Typically, we allow 3 minutes per speaker and a total of 20 minutes, but we're going to discuss among ourselves right now how we're going to handle that, because there are so many of you. If we were to go that long, it would go nearly an hour.
We have, to the board, we have six, right now, I see that we have 16 requests to speak. Typically, we would allow 20 minutes for complete public comment. So my question to the board is, in order to make sure that everybody gets heard, do we want to reduce the amount of time, for example, from 3 minutes to 2 minutes, which would allow everybody to make sure that they get their say, because we think that's really important? Or are there other ways that the board would like to do it? Limit it to an hour, for example, or whatever time the board would desire. So I'm going to just ask the board for their consensus on what they'd like to do at this point, and knowing that we're not going to do public comment until several items in. So,
well, if everyone who wishes to speak has submitted a form, if 16 is the true number, then 16 times 3 is 48.
48.
So about, I would suggest about an hour, actually.
So our options are to consider whether to expand it to an hour and allow people to speak 3 minutes, or whether to consider reducing the amount of individual time. Those are the options we're considering.
Good.
Walter's holding up three fingers.
Okay. Oh, that's, yeah, okay. I'm in favor of 3 minutes per speaker.
Okay.
With the, I guess, with the understanding that if someone has previously expressed what you came tonight to express, then you might limit your comment a little bit.
May I add, not to exceed an hour. So if someone runs long, they're cutting into someone else's time.
We'll enforce the 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll enforce 3 minutes. Okay.
Okay. So the decision.
So the decision of the board is 3 minutes per speaker, a maximum of 1 hour total for public comment. Is that agreeable to everybody? Okay, very good.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. So this is the section that we were announced with what we did just now in closed session, and what we did was we evaluated a public employee's superintendent. We also discussed a dismissal of an employee, and we listened to a student stipulated expulsion hearing. Do we have a consensus then on the order of business?
Yes.
Okay. We need to take a vote on the stipulated student discipline item.
I move approval of the stipulated expulsion agreement.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mrs. Shepherd. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That's 7-0. Next up, item number 4.03, approval of minutes of May 2nd, 2017, board meeting.
I move approval of the minutes of May 2nd.
And I'll second that, please.
Thank you. We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry, a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
That's 7-0. Item number 4.04, approval of the minutes of May 11th. There were two absences, myself and Mrs. Sheffer, on that date.
I'll move approval of the minutes for, where is it, May 11th.
And I'll second.
Motion by Mr. Millar with a second by Mrs. Roger. All in favor?
Aye.
That passes 5-0 with two abstentions, Mrs. Sheffer and myself. And now we have the pleasure of hearing from the student representatives to the board. Good morning, or good evening, actually.
Good evening. So to start off in San Luis Obispo High School news, girls softball won the league championship, and they will be moving on to CIF this Thursday. Last Friday, yeah. Last Friday was the senior night for boys baseball, and they beat St. Joe's in that. Unfortunately, they will not be going to CIF this year. Boys golf traveled to Solvang on Monday for CIF and did pretty well. Boys and girls swim and dive also won the league championship. Girls, however, won the league championship. Boys came in third, I believe. And they traveled to Riverside over the weekend and competed in CIF. Unfortunately, the girls did not make it back to finals, but the boys stayed and competed in finals. Track and field student athletes traveled down to Estancia to compete in CIF over the weekend, and they also did pretty well. The boys volleyball team traveled to Sherman Oaks, qualifying for the CIF playoffs, but unfortunately lost. Boys tennis team traveled down to Calabasas on Wednesday for CIF and came up a little bit short, losing in the end. And the spring end-of-the-year award ceremony is May 24th at 6 p.m. in the new gym. In ASB news, this week we're celebrating mental health awareness. So over the course of the week, we're having a bunch of activities such as yoga, Zumba. We're also doing this thing called happiness rock painting. And basically what you're doing is a student can come and paint a rock with an inspirational quote or something that makes them happy, and then they're going to place it around the campus for them to go back to if they need to have some inspiration for the day. This coming weekend is prom. Again, the theme is James Bond, 0017. So that'll be from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock at Mount Brook Church. And also prom King and Queen nominations went this week, and they will be found out tomorrow in the bulletin. Tiger Olympics is this coming Friday, so all elementary schoolers are going to come to Holt Field and participate in several activities put on by staff and students, along with campus tours. Next week is our senior recognition assembly, and all seniors wear their college shirts or the plans they have for the following year, and the Laguna and some other eighth graders come on campus for a tour as well. And last in ASB news, the senior showcase auditions went last week, and the acts have been chosen. In theater news, Footloose the Musical opened last Thursday with 8 performances through this Friday, May 19th. The tickets for the center section of the theater are online, but will be sold online, but the rest of the seats will be sold at the door. In FFA news, this past Saturday, May 6th, 36 San Luis Obispo High School students competed, comprising 9 different teams. They competed in the state finals held at Cal Poly. Our students did incredibly well, and many second and third place ribbons were awarded. Also, the Barn Bash will be held on Friday, May 19th. The event includes dinner, drinks, live music, dancing, and an auction. And last but not least, Christina Smelzer and Matthew White have been selected for the Frank Holt Memorial Most Outstanding Senior Award. The award honors seniors who exemplify leadership, service, and athletics. May 19th, this Thursday, is Empty Bowls Slow at Farmer's Market. We'll be located on Higuera Street between Garden and Choro, so it's going to be there for all of farmers from 6 to 9. And our ceramics teacher, Mrs. Edel, has been working with our students to create 500 unique bowls that'll be sold for $20 each to go to any restaurant down in San Luis Obispo for a bowl, and all the proceeds will go to 40 Prado Day Center. The Special Olympics was held on May 5th, so 10 of our San Luis Obispo High School Special Olympians competed at the annual Regional Special Olympics at Cuesta, and they proudly medaled in either gold or silver. So that's all we have for Slow High. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Busy time of year. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
And Ellis?
Well, firstly, I'd like to introduce Sierra Lyman. She will be at Morro Bay High School's ASB president next year.
Congratulations.
So a little while ago, Morro Bay premiered their brand new auto shop. That went really well. We had cars from all over the state come and I guess just display these amazing cars. We had a lot of people from the community as well as a lot of the board came to celebrate. In a little bit drearier news, SBAC testing happened today and will be happening tomorrow. And so far, as Sierra can attest to, it's going really well. Last week, the Morro Bay High School Band played a few songs with the Los Osos Middle School Band in a small-scale concert to give incoming freshmen a sneak peek at what it's like to play in the Pirate Band. Also this Wednesday, the Morbay High School and Loam's concert choirs will be performing at the Performing Arts Center at Cal Poly from 7 o'clock to 9:30. We also have our open house coming up this Thursday from 5:30 to 8 o'clock, and students will be presenting things like TED Talks and biotechnology presentations, as well as silent auctions, plant cells. We even have badminton and ping pong, so it should be a great night. So everybody should come out. Our underwater robotics team met in Santa Cruz and competed against 30 other high schools from all around California. They did really well and returned with some of the top scores out of all 30 of the other schools. A lot of girls attended the Latina Youth Leadership Conference put on by Lambda Theta Nu Sorority at Cal Poly. The girls had the opportunity to learn about developing healthy relationships, self-esteem, leadership skill development, and setting their path towards higher education. Several Morabay High School math students recently competed in the Trig Star Math Contest. This contest challenged students' problem-solving skills and computational expertise. In first place was Zainab Bhatti, second place was Haley Dyson, and third place was Orion Schwellenbach. All of the students received cash awards, and Zainab will move on to compete at the countywide level. Our athletic boosters presented the school with $8,000 to support our athletic programs. This was amazing, and students are really excited to use this money for new equipment and transportation. Morabay has also been celebrating Mental Health Awareness Month. Our peer helpers are collaborating with Ms. Brinkman's psychology class to present students with different positive activities all week long during lunch. Also, a group of psychology students made it possible for a school-wide painting day at lunch as part of this celebration of mental health. Tomorrow at Morabay is College Day, where college-bound seniors can show off their acceptances, and all students can participate in games and activities related to College Day. We'll also be celebrating students who chose to take other paths, and students will be showing off all of their accomplishments by wearing T-shirts and caps to make sure everybody knows. So ASB has been planning a lot of end-of-the-year events. We're starting it off with what we're calling Bubblepalooza, where students will relieve stress through finals and AP testing by just filling the quad and with bubbles. That's the whole event. It's just blowing bubbles. So it should be a great time. That's all we got for Morabay. Thank you.
Thank you. That sounds stress-reducing. And welcome, Sierra. Thank you for joining us. Now we have the opportunity to celebrate our retirees. And, Ms. Newland.
The celebration is always such a bittersweet one for me at the end of the year, because we are losing some outstanding staff members. 26 people have given us their resignation, and we have 14 people here today that we are honoring. And I would like to read their names in just a minute. But before I do that, I'd like you to know that each one of them has either picked a library book or had a library book chosen for them by Sharon Haupt, and those will go into our school libraries, and they're back in the back right in the corner here. So I hope you get an opportunity to look through what has been chosen for them. It's a great tradition, and we thank Sharon Haupt for that. For our retirees, congratulations. We will miss you. In the words of Dr. Seuss, don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. And we will truly miss you. We have a wonderful slideshow, because each one of our retirees has sent us photos of what they plan to do in retirement. And Jen O'Hagan, our master video producer, has put this together for us to see the what they plan to do in retirement. So I'm going to turn it over to Kim at this point in time to show you our presentation.
Thank you.
at this time, I'd like to ask the board to come up in front of the table, the dais here, and I'm going to read off the names of our retirees. And retirees, if you don't mind, just starting over here, they've given you little arrows to follow. Probably last time you're going to have to follow these kinds of directions. But the arrow starts here, and it goes right around there, over here to the end. So I'd like to start with Lori Anderson from Monarch Grove Elementary. Nancy Bedrigian, Laguna Middle School. Gail Becker, Sinsheimer Elementary. Stephen Boaz, San Luis Obispo High School. He said he may be able to make it, so he must not be here yet. Catherine Bonnet from Baywood Elementary. Guy Crabb, Teach Elementary. John Franklin, San Luis Obispo High School. Jean Harold, Student Support Services.
I know.
Nancy Hoyt, Morro Bay High School. Cherie Jones, San Luis Obispo High School. Christina Miranda, Copy Center, Tina. Linda Ortiz, Los Osos Middle School. Rick Robinette, Superintendent's Office. And last but not least, Deborah Sands from San Luis Obispo High School. So at this time, we'd like to take a short break and enjoy some cake in the back of the room. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for that celebration. And again, congratulations to all the retirees. We are ready for item number 6.01, which is correspondence. And there was no official correspondence that arrived at the office of Ms. Holmes. So we will move on to public comment.
Individually.
You among others.
And now we're ready for the public comments section. And Mr. Unger is going to call off names and start the timer. There will actually be a timer on the screen, and so you'll be able to see how much time you have remaining.
Right. And so we'll do two things. Actually, we'll do this a couple of this is the process I'd like to use. Mrs. Holmes will set up the three-minute timer. It'll be up there. when the 3 minutes is up, because we have so many people who want to speak tonight. We really do want to hear from everybody. We're going to limit it to 3 minutes, and so when the 3 minute timer is over, I'll be asking you to stop your speech at that point. Please don't think I'm being rude, but I do really believe that we want to hear from everyone. I'm also going to keep a timer of an hour because the board agreed that we would give everyone 3 minutes to speak, up to a maximum of an hour. So if there are other people that want to speak at the end, we'll have that as well. So I'm keeping that timed as well. What I'm going to do is I'm going to call two or three names at a time. I would ask that you line up behind the podium and speak in the order which I call, and just to make sure that we continue to have the flow of people. Again, as always, we would ask that you not necessarily make redundant comments. We know it's important for people to speak. You can say, for example, that you agree with a speaker. We listen to all comments. We take all your comments quite seriously. Saying that, I'm going to start the hour timer. Mrs. Holmes, would you start when we get the first speaker up, we'll start it when you get to the podium. The first three people in order will be Arik Sweeney, Emma Jane Haas, and Ella Jackson. So please, starting with Arik Sweeney, and then come on up.
And if you would please speak your name into the microphone when you begin.
Absolutely.
My name is Arik Sweeney.
I'm sorry, I mispronounced.
Oh, no, you're fine. I'll try to keep this brief. I'm one of Expression's editors-in-chief, and I am here to defend our choice to publish Mr. Sack's recent letter to the editor. Like I previously said in my interview with KSBY, it's important to give voices to both sides of an issue. However, we have received negative feedback from numerous students, parents, and general San Luis Obispo community members regarding Sack's choice to send us, a student-run publication, his opinion. Regardless of my thoughts on the content of Sack's letter, it's important to recognize that we were solely the vehicle for him to share his voice. Although we at Expressions have been categorized as a left-leaning paper, I think our true colors show when we allow opposite opinions of ours to be heard. If any publication read by hundreds, if not thousands of people, allowed only beliefs that the majority of their staff agreed with, it would stall the discussion and not represent everybody. Our intent to focus on the LGBTQ+ community was to further promote equality and open dialogue, and I think we've stood by that message during the last week. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Hi, my name is Emma Jane Haas. I'm also one of the three editors-in-chief of the So High Expressions newspaper. I've been a part of this paper for 3 years now, and throughout all of that, I've always felt lucky to have an open dialogue with the administration at our school. While there have been situations where the editors disagree with the opinion of the admin, they have always listened to our thoughts and offered their best advice. This situation is no different. Despite the controversial nature of Mr. Stack's letter to the editor, our admin stood by us and our decision to publish it. This is in no way warranted of an attack on the school. Yes, Mr. Stack's words were hateful, but our administration believes in the sharing of all opinions, and what's more, the right to free speech. Mr. Stack's despicable words are not representative of the staff or students at SLOHS. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anna Jean.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for allowing us to both speak and listen tonight. I'm Ella Jackson, and I am the third editor-in-chief of Expressions newspaper, and I specifically edit the feature pages, which were the pages that represented this year's controversy. I simply just wanted to address why we published what we published prior to even receiving Stack's letter to the editor. My purpose in printing this issue was to support a community while addressing a critical subject that is ever so present at San Luis Obispo High School. Myself, along with my fellow editor-in-chief, Emma Jane Haas, were the creators of the May cover of this issue, which sparked controversy to say the least. The cover depicts an image of two girls kissing, which, as shocking as it sounds in the year of 2017, is something that students witness every day. Journalism and controversy go hand in hand. But speaking for everyone behind Expressions, we publish and welcome absolutely every single perspective. The May issue was simply a portrayal of this. I wanted to be clear that in publishing this issue and by selecting these articles in particular, I felt that it was imperative that we highlight a group of people despite the public comments and opinions that would eventually arise. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is, I'm going to call four names this time, Scott Nairn, Whitney Burns, Bridget Bogost, and Stephen Savaridra. I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name.
Savedra.
Scott Nairn, advisor of San Luis Obispo Expressions, and tough act to follow. I'm going to reiterate what they said. I stand behind what they said. And I had just a prepared statement. I've seen a lot of the public commentary and press concerning this issue. And I don't think it was the intent of the editors or myself at any time to cause harm to either side of this issue. I sense that my students and my district and site leadership get that. I stand 100% behind the district's two press releases. I thought they were brilliant, and I'm going to use them in my class next year as a teachable moment. And I stand completely behind the informed student position, informed student decisions that you just heard. So, thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Whitney Burns, and I'm a co-president of Slo High's Gay Straight Alliance. As controversial as the last week has been, I've never felt so supported and loved by my fellow students and staff at Slo High. I've always felt that my school is inclusive, and I was honored to be interviewed in the Expressions LGBTQ edition. Mr. Stack's letter deeply offended me, as I'm sure it did many of my peers, yet I fully support our newspaper's decision to publish the letter in the way our admin handled the situation. As cruel as some people's opinions may be, they should not be sheltered, especially in a school environment where debate and discussion should be encouraged. Slo High School is a place for all opinions to be heard, and Mr. Stack's letter is no exception. What spoke to me was the way the community reacted. The support I received from my teachers, peers, and administration was more than I could have ever asked for. I know that Slo High will continue to be a community for all opinions and one that includes and protects LGBTQ students. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bridget Bogus, and I am the advisor for GSA, and I'm also a teacher at San Luis Obispo High School. Unfortunately, I have to follow two really good student speakers. So Mr. Stack's letter, when I heard of it during second period, kind of threw me. It was not a typical voice that we hear at San Luis High. While people are encouraged to say their opinion and speak their beliefs, I've never heard of any teacher using a classroom as a pulpit or specifically using the Bible to disenfranchise or take away anybody's rights or make them feel unwelcome. San Luis High is really a microcosm of our society. It's as safe, I would imagine, for students on our campus as they are in their front yards at home. Possibly safer because there's more students looking out for them and teachers looking out for them, and we do gate control a bit. But the administration, the teachers, the staff, from the bus drivers just dropping kids off and picking them up to Mr. O'Connor, who's here, and the groundspeople who are still there. All the way down, top to bottom, our school is student-centered. It's about the students. It's about what teaching is and good teaching is. And while I heartily disagree with the letter and the platform of religion through a student newspaper, I do appreciate that our newspaper honors free choice, and I do believe that this really ignited the GSA students. No offense, GSA students, you guys were a little slacky this year. And no, seriously, I'm still trying to get a dance planned. But it really ignited the dialogue. It got students talking. It got them talking with people they didn't usually talk to. And I think some students that were on the opposite side that agreed with Mr. Stack may have felt a little intimidated, but those students, I believe, have also been encouraged, as I have, by staff that's come up that I know absolutely disagree with me as a gay woman, but definitely respect me as a teacher and a member of our Slo High community and support me to do our job and support our students to be successful. So I like that this focused on what we do right, and I would like not to let some people run away with it and make it seem like this is a voice of many members of our community, because I don't believe it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Stephen Svedra. Well, Mr. Stack's submission to the newspaper at our school was kind of uncalled for. Well, I don't agree with what he said. I don't think that this was the appropriate platform for Mr. Stack to express his opinions, especially those that could potentially harm other students or pose a risk for students to do something that the school wouldn't want. Having to deal with the LGBT community, they have a higher suicide rate, and I think that should have been taken into account before, you know, just publishing it. I think freedom of speech and freedom of expression is extremely important, but also the safety of our students, and I think that was completely overlooked here. Yes. Well, Mr. Stack's opinions, you know, weren't that great, in my opinion at least. I think, you know, it did promote a conversation, but at what, you know, risk? And I think that risk was too high. I think we also missed a learning opportunity for the expressions students here. With all respect, I think, you know, their paper is doing a great job. But I think perhaps the administration missed this part, and this controversy could have been avoided. Furthermore, sorry, I'm lacking. Oh, here we go. sorry, I didn't prepare anything tonight. I have always seen, you know, teachers have opposing viewpoints to what may be popular at school, and respectfully, they don't voice them because teachers are held to a certain standard, which I think, or standard of manners and behavior that they should abide by. And the San Luis Obispo High School, and I'm sure the rest of the district, always demonstrated the best behavior that I have seen, and I think that's really something to show. This was just one little instance where something got under, I guess, the administration's eyes, and well, I doubt it will happen again, and I say keep on showing that great behavior. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next is Ellie Axelroth, followed by Ellen Sturtz and Gay Smith.
Good evening. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak tonight. I'm Ellie Axelroth. I'm a longtime resident of San Luis Obispo. I have two children who graduated from San Luis High. I'm also a retired psychologist and was director of the Counseling Center at Cal Poly. In my years of practice, I spent many hours working with LGBTQ students as they were coming out to friends, roommates, family members, and struggling with what it means to be gay or queer or trans. First of all, I want to thank Principal O'Connor for making himself available during the recent protest outside SLO High. He was generous with his time, and we had a lengthy conversation about free speech and what would constitute a hostile environment. While I appreciate Mr. O'Connor's time and his obvious desire to be welcoming to LGBTQ students, I'm concerned that the school administration does not fully appreciate the challenges these students experience. The California Healthy Kids Survey reported that almost half of all LGBT students in this district said they had seriously considered attempting suicide in the past 12 months. They were 7 times more likely than their heterosexual peers to miss school because they didn't feel safe. Transgender youth were twice as likely to report having been pushed, shoved, slapped, hit, kicked on a school campus. I know that the vast majority of teachers, parents, and administrators in our school district want to be supportive of the LGBT students in our schools, but it's not enough to say we're supportive. It's not enough to write what I regarded as a lukewarm press release in response to Michael Stack's offensive, inflammatory letter to the editor. In my conversation with Mr. O'Connor, it is clear that he believes he is in touch with the LGBT students at SLO High. My guess is that he's in touch with those students most comfortable with their sexual identity, who are out to their parents and friends, but those students who are most marginalized, most vulnerable, most isolated are not coming to talk to him. Quite the contrary. And a letter to the editor like the one from Mr. Steck only confirms their fears of what will happen if they come out to their family and peers. When a teacher writes that he believes gays will be punished, it is not empty rhetoric. To those students already vulnerable and isolated, his words are consequential. Making SLO High School truly welcoming for all its students requires a recognition of the barriers facing LGBTQ youth and a proactive, sustained effort at addressing their concerns. Let's show all of our students that our efforts don't end with the end of the school year. Thank you.
I'm the third name on the list. My name is Gay.
Oh.
I have only been in this community for almost 3 years, and I do not get the newspaper. I do not watch television. I have learned of this incident based on comments made on Facebook. I thought about what words could I use. As you can see, I have nothing written. This is off the cuff completely, and I was drawn to this cause. I have no idea who any student, who any teacher might be in this room. Board, I want to thank you for allowing me to step up here. What I know is that I am a substance abuse counselor and that I am a child development teacher. I've worn both hats, preschool teacher, after school care, and a substance abuse counselor. Last year, I had the opportunity to go to the session on the Trevor Project. If you have not had an opportunity as an educator to go to one of the workshops on the Trevor Project, I would encourage you to do so. The numbers that my fellow speakers shared on the number and percentage of children that are attempting suicide because they do not have someone to speak on their behalf, I want you to think about that. I have no stance on as to whether or not your feedback was right or wrong. I want to commend the journalism class and the paper for standing up for a part of the population that grows harmed, if not murdered. Every person in this room has to challenge themselves as to what can I do. I consider myself an ally. The name Gaye, G-A-Y-E, was blessed to me when I was born 64 years ago. My mother had no idea what the name Gaye would lead to. I went to a place this evening before I came to order my food. What's your name? Gaye. Once again, in this very upbeat place, it was, your order's ready. My name is Gaye, G-A-Y-E. I am an ally. I want to use all of my power I can to empower a student that is struggling. And I would like to encourage all of the teachers and the professional staff in the district to do the same. Empower every child that you have been called to empower. Direct. Do no harm. Allow them to thrive. Let them become educators because you have been kind enough to open your arms and embrace these students. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Connie Moore. I have Emma Haas again and Miss and Rabbi Bernthal.
Hello. My name is Connie Moore and I'm the people editor for Expressions. I would like to say how proud I am to be part of Expressions in the past few weeks. Our editors met and together decided to do a feature on LGBTQ+ students' lives at SLO High. We hoped that doing so could start a conversation, and we suspected that using the cover picture we chose would likely provoke some controversy. Little did we realize that the publishing of that cover photo and then Mr. Stack's letter to the editor would lead to a conversation, not just at our high school, but throughout our community, our state, and even nation. I believe publishing Mr. Stack's letter was essential in order to keep our newspaper fair and unbiased. Journalism is about finding the truth, and if only one belief is represented, the truth cannot be found. I believe that his letter, more than anything, helped draw attention to the LGBTQ+ cause and open a conversation. Not only did it open a conversation in our own community, but across the globe. It is imperative for issues such as freedom of speech and LGBTQ plus rights to be brought into the light. Once a conversation is opened, the issue can be debated and argued. Only then can progress be made. I'm happy that Slow Justice's own newspaper can be part of that important conversation and progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Haas, did you wish to speak again?
No.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Rabbi Linda Burtenthal. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm speaking about the same thing everyone was speaking about tonight. And I want to bring some particular concerns. As a rabbi, as a Jewish leader, I'm always concerned that separation of church and state be upheld. And I do believe that when acting as a teacher in a public school, Mr. Stack is a state actor. He is bound by the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution to refrain from imposing his particular religious beliefs upon others in that school setting. And there's really no question that his letter called upon the students of the school to accept his particular religious understanding with kind of an or else hanging over their heads. And especially given his position of power over students as a teacher, this proselytizing conduct, in my opinion, violated the Establishment Clause. And it wasn't proper speech. The other reason I feel that his letter really did not constitute proper speech is that I found his language to constitute hate speech and that it was both defamatory and threatening. Defamatory in the sense that he seemed to assert that LGBTQ people engage in every kind of wickedness, including murder. That's per se defamation. He also seemed to assert that LGBTQ people deserve to die. And while that is like abstract threatening language, it does become concrete when you consider the much greater risk of being bullied, including physically assaulted, that our gay and lesbian and trans students face. And also just overtly harmful when you consider the suicide statistics that Eli Axelrath cited, that phrase, they know they deserve to die, was like a knife in the heart of someone, and we don't know who. I have to say, as a Jew, when a Christian tries to proselytize me, it feels like an assault on my identity. If I were a gay student in the school, I would feel like that letter was not only an assault on my identity, but an assault on my right to be alive. How can you make students feel that they are truly included and that they are truly safe in an environment where a teacher, uses this kind of language in a letter that is published for the whole school to read? So I do want to ask the district to please take immediate steps to reassure its students and their families and the community that you recognize students' right to be free from proselytization by district personnel, including teachers, and that you recognize your responsibility to make the school environment truly safe and inclusive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So next is Michelle Call, followed by Luca McDougall and Laura Albers.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak. I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Jewish, but I'm not observant. When I was 16, a youth group leader from the local church got my friend to invite me to a retreat. I went away for a weekend of skiing and came back as a member of a church that believed masturbation was immoral, we should only speak to those who weren't Christians in order to convert them, evolution didn't happen, and that gays were going to hell. I was a vulnerable teen without a fully formed brain, and that youth leader had undue influence. He wasn't from the school, because in school it's understood that there is a separation of church and state, and the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution is upheld. I think about scenarios where a Jehovah's Witness teacher might tell a student that the life-saving blood transfusion they need will lead to eternal damnation. A Jewish or Muslim teacher telling a student it's wrong to eat bacon. or a science teacher telling a student that religion of any kind is foolish and making her question her family's beliefs. The reason the First Amendment protections are in place is to prevent this kind of thing. Religion must be irrelevant in school. This isn't about punishing the school paper, the school, or the students who chose to publish. It's about changing the attitude towards religious expression in school, most particularly the privileging of Christianity. From Principal O'Connor's defense of Michael Stack, quote, O'Connor said that Stack's viewpoint comes from a place of religious conviction, adding that he believes Stack is a very good and decent person, unquote. If teachers and students do indeed agree with what Michael Stack wrote, then we need to have a much bigger conversation about how Christianity is privileged inherently by the administration and how to train faculty and staff to refrain from influencing students in this way. Many people of religious conviction have come out to say this fundamentalist judgmental point of view is not shared by their communities. Regardless, the school district, though it may say that as Mr. Stack resigned, quote, here we did not need to reach a conclusion, unquote, could not be more mistaken, as it is clear he proselytized to students. LGBTQ is not a choice, it is a protected class. It may not be discriminated against, and faculty and staff may not promote any religious judgment against the existence of LGBTQ people. As this is not the first time this kind of issue has come up, whatever measures are now in place are clearly not preventing what has happened here, and we need a new plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Luca MacDougall, and I'm the opinion editor for Expressions. I'm also the co-president of the Gay-Straight Alliance at Slo High, and I'm an openly gay student as well. The letter that Mr. Stack wrote offended me on many levels. As a gay person, as a person with morals, and as a student at a public high school, this deeply offended me to my core. While I'm happy that he resigned, I do respect his personal beliefs and his religion. I personally believe that the school has done what they can in this short amount of time in the wake of such controversy and such public outrage. I really don't think there's any such thing as a perfect school, and there's always something that a community, and especially a school, can do to make sure that their students feel welcome. And I think without giving them the opportunity to show that they can do that, is just unfair. The letter to the editor was published a week ago. In that time, many news sources have only just picked it up, and all this outrage is justified, but when it's directed with malicious intent towards the school and its administrators, I think that's just really unfair to everybody involved. And as for the gay community at Slo High, I think a lot of it is not out and proud yet, and anything that the district or the school board or the school or the administrators want to do in cooperation with the LGBTQ community at Slo High to advance LGBT students' openness at school would be welcomed and appreciated. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Laura Albers. I was raised in the Episcopal Church, earned a degree in elementary education from Pepperdine University, a Christian university. I was required to take religion courses, including an entire semester of New Testament and an entire semester of Old Testament. I hold a graduate degree in public administration. I have two children who have been educated in San Luis Coastal, one a recent Slo High School grad and one finishing his junior year at Slo High School. I also host foreign exchange students in my home and have been employed by San Luis Coastal as a substitute teacher. I'm here tonight to express my disappointment in the district and Slo High's responses to Mr. Stack's letter and expressions. In your first response letter, you claim you want, quote, all of our students and families to feel safe and welcomed regardless of sexual orientation, gender, religious, or political beliefs. I would like to know how defending a public school teacher's statement to students that gay students are sinful, wicked, and deserve to die is encouraging your students to feel safe and welcomed.
I have heard this week from several students that, in fact, they do not feel safe. And while I am very happy tonight to hear that there are some students, the newspaper and the GSA chair people, that do feel supported, there are other students, whether you've heard from them or not, who do not feel safe to come and speak here tonight or to the administration. In your second response letter, you state that our district, quote, takes great pride in representing the rights of all students and will continue to support its LGBTQ plus student community and adhere to all of California's laws that provide for much deserved protection. If that is true, where is the First Amendment protection of all students to feel safe and protected as required under the Establishment Clause? Where is the adherence to California Ed Code, which requires that school personnel take immediate steps to intervene when he or she witnesses an act of discrimination, harassment, intimidation, or bullying? By stating to students that gay students are sinful, wicked, and deserve to die, Mr. Stack was engaged in discrimination, harassment, intimidation, and bullying by any definition you care to employ. In jumping to Mr. Stack's defense, the school and district administration became complicit in these acts, and rather than protecting our students, you protected the bully. There are two possible reasons I can see for your response. One, you agree with Mr. Stack's beliefs and therefore don't think he was doing any harm because you too wish that gay students would turn from their wickedness. Or two, you were trying to avoid legal suits filed by Mr. Stack, accusing you of infringing upon his constitutional right to free speech. Either of those options have no place in our public school system. It is only from a very privileged position that someone could expect marginalized groups to simply accept that Mr. Stack was praying for them. What you might not understand from a white Christian perspective is that praying for someone does not equate support or safety. In fact, to some people, this can be considered an act of aggression. I now call on San Luis Coastal School District Board and Administration, as well as the high school's administration, to proceed with the following. One, issue an immediate apology to all its students, acknowledging that they deserve your support and acceptance, and mainly devise a program where students can talk with someone outside of the district administration when they feel wronged, and it's important that that person be unable to exact punishments on whistleblowers.
Could you please, thank you. And if you'd like, you can make written comments that the board would be happy to read. Thank you. Next is Axel Reich, I believe. Is that how you pronounce your last name? Thank you.
Well, I know there were a lot of people who were speaking about Mr. Stack, and I appreciate all those people who spoke on those issues, but I'm going to speak about something different. I'm Axel Reich. I am a freshman at Slo High, and recently I have been looking for ways to improve our education system in this district. I've compiled my ideas into 9 proposals in a bill that I call the Student Bill of Rights. I do not have time to cover every aspect of the bill right now, but here's a summary of what it says. Although our schools in this district have some of the best marks in California, many students, at Slo High at least, believe that the system of education can still be improved. 200 of these people have signed on to the Student Bill of Rights. Many students right now do not like being at school because they feel that it is at least somewhat unfree. If we could make our school's rules more specific, allowing for more freedom, but still keeping our students safe, we could have more successful students because they would begin to like their schools more, and people will learn more when they like their education. Many people also feel that the education system is too fact-based, making it boring, and again, leading to students not liking their classes. I believe that we can create an education curriculum that will attempt to be interactive and interesting for our students. One of the other issues that I would like to speak on is homework. Many studies have shown that homework does not help students do better in class, and instead gets in the way of extracurricular activities that have been proven to help a student do better in school. For the full bill, I have emailed it to the school board members. And I know this sounds like a kid complaining about homework, but I really care. I really care about everyone's good education, and that is why I would like you, the school board, to agendize this bill for discussion in another school board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all the requests we have for public comment. We'll close public comment now, and back to Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Thank you all for your comments.
Thank you. You're welcome to stay, or we can give you a moment to take your leave if you'd like as well, students and adults. We're now moving on to item number 7.01, the business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, well, the governor revealed... Wait, tell everybody. The governor released his May revise, and so it was kind of an interesting, because the economy's been a little up and down over the past few months in terms of overall funding. There were some, I'd say, more on the positive side, especially for state-funded districts, in terms of extra money towards LCFF, kind of bringing it up to a 97% rate in terms of overall, kind of the funding aspect of it. For us as a district, as a basic aid district, there was an increase in one-time funds potentially coming out of the May revise, so we'll see what's going to happen with that. It was interesting in that the governor, with that increase in one-time funds, and of course we're having our public hearing tonight for the budget, where Julie can discuss that a little bit, but he's not going to fund the one-time money until later on in the end of the year. So just kind of an interesting caveat that I hadn't seen, in the many years that we've seen one-time money, those types of things. So basically saying, hey, as long as the economy's good, we'll give it out, and if not, I'll pull it back in. I'd say probably the only other negative aspect that came out of the May revise is just the release of state funds for construction. So it seems like dragging his feet a little bit in terms of getting those dollars out. Of course, for us, as we're moving forward, we have a lot of CTE pathway classrooms that are going to be modernized. And so the sooner that those dollars are released, the sooner we can apply for them to help supplement our Measure D fund. So that's just kind of a basic backdrop to the May revise. And again, Julie's tonight we'll be talking a lot more about the budget.
Okay. Thank you very much. And moving on to 7.02, Educational Services Update with Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. Just a reminder that open house continues at many of our schools. We have Thursday Sensheimer, and many schools are celebrating open house next week. So it's a great opportunity for teachers and staff to further connect with families and create a real team around a student. So just wanted to remind everyone about attending open house. And Dr. Prater wanted to add something as well.
Yes, Board. Thank you for the public comment. That was really helpful to hear, and I wrote down as much as I could, furiously as I could. And what I have a prepared statement, and I think it follows up on much of what the core of what you heard. But to ensure that both students and employees in our district understand their First Amendment rights, and more importantly, the limits of their rights. Next fall, we will conduct trainings for our principals. We will use a trainer of trainer model, and so we'll train our principals with the help of experts in First Amendment law. And we'll break this down into two modules. The first module will be one focused on employees and their free speech rights, and one focused on student free speech rights. And we will use that opportunity as a trainer of trainers so that principals will then be trained. They will provide this update to their staff at the beginning and start of the school year. And their students, the principals will work with their students at their respective secondary sites in ways to make sure that each school site's needs are properly addressed accordingly. This training program is intended to help ensure that this experience is treated as a learning opportunity for us all. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Prater. And now we're up to 7.03, Measure D update with Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so we had a bond sale today, $50 million. So big bond sale, second sale, Series B. All indications after today was that it went really well, that we got a great, you know, total interest cost. Recently, we had our ratings done through Moody's, AAA, our AA+. So what that does is kind of like for any of you here to go out and buy a car or to buy a house, or you know, when you have better credit, you get a better interest rate. And in this case, we're talking about a district interest rate. So that the public pays back, right? So the fact that the district has such a great fiscal standing, stable board, doing things the right way, that's why we receive those excellent ratings. And so, you know, as the bonds are repaid through property tax payments, the better that interest rate we can get, the easier and the less the overall cost is to the public in terms of paying those dollars back. And so I'm going to have Mr. Isom kind of do a kind of two-fold comparison for the board to share. One will be kind of how does Series B compare to Series A? And, of course, you have to take into account market changes from 2015 to 17, so looking at that. And then also kind of a comparison of like districts, like, you know, ratings over the past couple of months. So how do we compare in terms of this competitive? Because on this case, we did a negotiated sale. Last time it was a competitive sale. And so we want to analyze that data, kind of see. But from what we received this morning, everything looked really good. It looked very similar to our first bond series, which had a really good interest rate. So overall, just a positive day. Mr. Isom was very happy in terms of the outcome. And so we'll be sharing that information with the board.
Excellent. Thank you. And moving on to the tentative agreement with SEIU, and that is being presented by Ms. Newland.
Yes, so this is our new tentative agreement with SEIU for this year, and it does two major things. The first thing is it eliminates food service bidding. We have two groups in our organization that do bidding for their positions. The first is bus drivers. This is not eliminating bus driver bidding, but it is eliminating food service bidding. And so it will look more like the rest of our classified service where you get a position and you maintain that position until you end up, until something becomes open, and then you can transfer into another position. The second thing that it does is it guarantees a minimum of 4 hours for each food service position. So those are the two things that this tentative agreement does. It has been approved by the SEIU members and is before you for final approval. Oh, this is a resolution. I'm sorry. This is not
actually a public hearing.
So the public gets an opportunity to weigh in on this public hearing, and then later it shows up on the agenda for your approval in the consent part of the agenda. But I did want to explain it to you and to the public if there's anyone here that would like to speak to this item.
So we are opening the public hearing. Is there anyone who would like to speak to this issue? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing. Thank you, Mrs. Newland. We move on to item number 8.02, which is the energy service contract, and that is being presented by Mr. Pinkerton. Mr. Palazzo, sorry.
Good evening. So what we're bringing forward tonight is a second energy services contract for the Los Osos Middle School project. As you remember, several months back, we initiated into an agreement with Toma Electric to provide energy consulting and services to reduce our energy load at Los Osos Middle School. In other words, lighting retrofits mostly as part of our zero net energy program at that site. At the time, we used data from our auditor who had provided a
count of fixtures, if you will, and unfortunately he had only used a sampling of that and failed to tell us that when we went out to get pricing. So that's the bad news. The good news is that we did a couple things as part of that activity of re-looking at the campus as a whole, namely the number of fixtures we were putting in every classroom. Initially when we brought this forward, it was a one-for-one replacement. In other words, if a classroom had 10 fixtures, we were putting 10 back in. When this occurred, when we discovered this error on that audit part, we decided to relook at how many fixtures should go in each classroom, mostly. And we're able to reduce the number of fixtures in each classroom by about 10%, and still maintain the same light levels because the LED fixtures have a little more efficiency in terms of the way they disperse the light. So the good news is overall, campus-wide, we're significantly reducing our light count or light fixture count, if you will. We're doing the entire campus at this point with these lighting retrofits, save for the relocatables, which already have a fairly high efficiency fixture in them. Not necessarily LED, but it's a high-end fluorescent fixture. So we don't have to do those. Those are already saving us money. And this is kind of finishing that up. So we're going to save significantly more money, but we've got to spend a little bit to do that. The funding source for this is one, partly from the grant that we're getting from PG&E to the tune of about $200,000, and the remaining $300,000 ± will come from our Prop 39 funds. So again, there's still $0 out of pocket from the district. It's part of our grants that we've received to do this work. So tonight we're seeking opening and closing the public hearing on this specific item, and then resolution and approval for the contract as well. So. At that point, if there are any questions or if we have.
At this point, we'll open the public hearing to the public. Anyone who cares to speak to this item? Seeing no one, close the public hearing.
I know it's kind of boring sometimes. There's not much to say about saving money, right?
We'll have Anthony come back up when it's the resolution.
Yes.
Okay.
To
answer
okay.
any questions.
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Palazzo. Moving on to item number 9.01.
So this is a resolution for Classified Employee Week, which in 1986, the legislature designated the third full week in May to be observed as Classified Employee Week. And in your packet, you'll see a letter from our two local unions, SEIU and CSEA, supporting this resolution. And I'd like to read it to you now. Whereas classified school employees provide valuable services to the schools and students of the district, and whereas classified school employees contribute to the establishment and promotion of a positive instructional environment, and whereas classified school employees serve a vital role in providing for the welfare and safety of the district students, and whereas classified employees employed by the district and represented by California School Employees Association, CSEA, and Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and confidential employee units strive for excellence in all areas relative to the educational community. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Trustees of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District hereby recognizes and wishes to honor the contributions of the classified school employees to quality education in the state of California and in the San Luis Coastal Unified School District, and declares the week of May 21st through May 27th, 2017, as Classified School Employee Week.
Thank you. This is
I move the adoption or the proclamation resolution number 21-16-17. Thank you, Mr. Millar. I hope you will second it. A proclamation designating May 21st through 27th as Classified School Employee Week.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry, seconded by Mr. Unger. This is a roll call vote.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you. Moving on to item number 9.02, Mr. Pinkerton. This is another resolution.
So, we actually have, I believe, four lease-leaseback resolution approval. If it's okay with the board, we can go through each one and do all four as a one-time kind of A across the board, if that's okay. If that works for everybody, we'll still go through all of them, talk about them, but under one vote. Ms. Holmes, okay?
Kind of need to scan the board because it's important that you will all be voting identically, and then I can record those motions properly. If there's going to be any deviation, then we need to pull it out and take a separate vote.
Okay, treat it like a consent agenda?
Yeah.
Okay. So over the past 2 years, we've been going through major planning, talk to the board about delivery methods. We've had several study sessions talking about delivery methods. And so moving forward, we did at the two comprehensive high schools anyways, half of the projects were done under design build. So which is a project delivery method where the architect, kind of leads it up to bridging docks and then they take it from there. So with the other project, at the time we were looking at a design bid build delivery method. And so what we know and what have found out is that there are pros and cons to that delivery method. In particular, in a market where we have a lot of school bonds, a lot of school construction, we can see prices rise dramatically. And there's a lot of unknowns. Even with our sewer bids that we recently did over the past summer, we had bids that were right on target, and then we had bids that were three times as much, and we had to go back out. What we're finding in talking to other school districts around, their design bid build projects are coming in really high over the past month. And so that's why we came to the board to discuss the lease-leaseback method of construction and delivery. So in our study sessions, we've kind of brought that. We had Deidre Sakai from DWK discuss it with the board, talk about it. We actually went through the RFQ, RFP for those lease-leaseback contractors at our last study session last Thursday, which is an open public forum for anybody to hear where we get really in-depth. So just for the public's sake, as we go through these a little fast at a board meeting like tonight, it's because the board has spent hours going through those at those study sessions. Okay, so I think it's just good for the public to know that. So in this case, as part of the lease-leaseback agreement, we have broken them up into different resolutions. And the purpose for doing that and talking with our attorney is that it allows us to do each project under the same RFQ, RFP, which is why the resolutions are being passed tonight, and then we can do each project as a separate project in terms of the contracts. So later on tonight, we're going to bring forward two of the four projects at Morro Bay High School, two of the four contracts at San Luis Obispo High School. As those projects are bid, as we actually get a guaranteed maximum price for each one of those, we'll be sharing that back with the board as well. So there's several kind of input points for the board to kind of see, hey, here's where the project's at. This is what the cost is coming back, tying it into the overall budget that has been set aside for both schools as well as the overall Measure D budget. So there's lots of decision points throughout, I guess, is my point as we move through this process. The positive for me, I would say, in this in particular, it was great. We got a lot of construction companies to give us responses to our RFQ, RFP, which is a request for proposal. And so over nine firms at both San Luis Obispo High School as well as Morro Bay High School. Through that process, we have to come up with a best value methodology. So, Mrs. Holmes, if you'll click on the scoring matrix there. And again, we went through this all at the study session. I just want to go over some key points for the public tonight so that they understand. But so there's on the left, there's these criteria in terms of it where basically the respondents are given points based on kind of these key areas, technical expertise, subcontractor, schedule, staffing. And what we found across the board, to be short, is that all nine firms are great school construction firms. Any one of them could have done the work and worked for us. So what really kind of boiled down as we went through the scoring was really price. And so price really dictated kind of the key firms that won. And so at Morro Bay High School, that firm was Acme Construction. At San Luis Obispo High School, that firm was Acme Construction. At C.L. Smith Elementary School, which is the front of the school and modernization, it was Mano Construction. And at Morrow Elementary, where its roofing as well as painting project was RSH Construction. So not the nine firms were Morrow Bay, nine firms San Luis Obispo High School. I believe we had five firms for C.L. Smith, and I believe we had four firms at Morrow Elementary. So again, the staff went through this, graded them best value, and that's what the resolution tonight in front of you is saying, that you are accepting that the firm, in this case, again, for those firms I outlined, that those are the firms that provide the best value. It's not just price, but since all of the firms were you know, able to do the work, it really, price really dictated it. And so, Mrs. Holmes, if you go back and kind of just click on the price as well, just so that the board sees, public sees, substantial dollars. So if we can blow it up, right, and again, this is construction costs that included profit and overhead, general conditions, which are kind of the things that a company needs to run the project at the school site, as well as bonding that takes place, and insurance. So those are all key components that you tie into price. And so you'll see anywhere from a $1.8 million fee all the way down to, what's the bottom? Because I can't read it. What is it?
$4 million.
So $4 million. So again, that variance really dictated, right? So price was a key component, as well as it should be, as we move forward. So that breakdown of the firms, I feel really good for us. There's some positives that came out of it in terms of, I think, at both comprehensive high schools to have the same firm doing the design build as well as our lease-leaseback will definitely provide some positives in terms of staffing and working with one group. The other nice part is that firm in particular is really tied into a lot of our local contractors and our local subs. And so a lot of like the design build work right now that they're doing is mostly local firms that they're working with, so RM Architects and Tome Electric. So even though they're an outside firm, they have basically really tied into our local construction community, which is helping us get this work done. And again, it's always nice when those Measure D dollars go right back into our local construction environment. So that's kind of a synopsis of kind of the RFQ, RFP, the resolutions for you tonight is basically stating that those firms at Morrow Bay High School, again, it is the J building, the old gymnasium upgrades, the new student services building, and the new track and field, Acme Construction. At San Luis Obispo High School, it's the new annex classroom building. It's the old gym remodel, some new gym remodeling, the new student services building, the pool and the track and field projects. At Morrow Elementary, it's the roof and the paint. At C.L. Smith, again, it's the front of the campus, modernizing kind of a bus turnout, and the office. And so that is what I have for you tonight. So how the board wants to potentially have questions on the process, be happy to answer those. Otherwise, I know, again, we went through this all at the study session, so you received a lot of the information at that point.
Are there questions from the board? Mr. Buckman, did you have a question?
Yes, thanks. A lot of work here, a lot of excitement. I'm glad we sold the bonds at a good rate.
Yes.
It all sounds good. At least in the energy contract, and this may be for Mr. Holcomb, but there is now a section where there's a penalty for not finishing on time.
Okay.
And I've asked as a board member about that before. And the penalty is
$100.
$100?
It's $1,000 a day.
$1,000 a day? Thanks.
So you're talking about the energy contract or one of the lease-leaseback projects?
I think it's the energy contract.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I'm talking about the...
even $1,000 a day.
And we're going to approve the energy... So just so the board, sorry if I wasn't clear, the energy one we're going to do next.
Okay.
After the lease-leaseback, so that's okay.
So within the contract, there's now
a there are normally penalties assessed.
There normally are.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Great. And then the other thing I'd like to just mention is I really like the education component within these contracts that requires apprenticeship working with the subs. So
yeah,
just wanted to mention that.
So part of the new laws and regulations have that as tied to it.
And Mrs. Sheffer, you have a question?
You know, the only thing I wanted to add is that everything for the public, everything you see here, all these resolutions,
yes,
because we're voting on them as kind of a package, this is all available online. It's available on our website. So we're not trying to lump anything together. We're just trying to save time. So since they're so similar and the delivery method is the same, so all of this is available on our website for anyone to take a look at.
Thank you, Mrs. Shepherd. Mrs. Roger.
Hi. I just have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, Mrs. Holmes, could you bring back up the screen that you just...
The scoring matrix or the price?
The scoring. Well, this one. The price.
The price.
Sometimes you might look at a spread like that.
Uh-huh.
Could you reduce it just a wee bit so we can see?
Just go down to the bottom and show the...
Yeah. When you have a spread like that, you might say, well, the low bidder may not be responsible because he is so much lower
yes.
than the bidders in the middle, and the high bidder was looking at a different project, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So you would throw that one out. So I'm just am wondering, in determining that Acme's bid was a responsible bid, given the price difference, what did we do? Could you just tell me briefly?
Yeah, so again, this is unlike a design bid build kind of bid where they get the plans and they, you know, put their number together and they rush it in and they give it to us type of thing. This is more of a percent, you know, they had to put together kind of a percentage of what they expect the job to be, what they are going to charge us in terms of a profit and overhead amount. But this is also a whole RFP that goes with it. So it's almost like they had to put together a resume that went to, together with their price.
Mm-hmm.
When you do design bid build, there's no resume. If I'm the low bid, it doesn't matter what my resume has, and it doesn't necessarily matter if I left things out of the project. You have to take the low bid. So in this case, we got to actually, hey, look at their resume. Make sure that, you know, they can do the job. They can tie in. They can get subs. They can get this work done. On top of it, we also get to look at their price and make that determination the best value to the district, right? And so those were, you know, kind of the key components and why we actually have looked at lease back as a delivery model is a positive one for us, because now we're able to lock in a really good contractor who can help us get the job done, and we've kind of locked in some of those pricing components. But that resume aspect of it and being able to help, you know, select who's going to do the work is critical versus you just don't know sometimes in a design bid build who's going to bid.
So you sat down with the low bidder and determined that it's a responsible bid. It
yes.
has everything that we
Absolutely.
That we're looking for in it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
The chair will entertain a motion.
You want to take public comment?
Oh, sorry, yes. So is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Okay, and seeing no one. Ms. Jeff?
I would like to make a motion that we accept resolution 22-16-17 25-16-17 26-16-17 through 31-16-17 32-16-17 33-16-17
I'd like to second that, please.
No, he's doing that. Then I'm not including that because he said he was going to do that separately.
Okay, and I'm
so it's everything about the energy services?
Yes, I did not yeah. include that. You said you were doing that separately.
We'll talk about that next.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Because it's not a lease back.
So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Buckman.
Thank you.
It's a roll call vote.
To be clear, we're approving all of the resolutions in items 9.02 through item 9.05.
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman? Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Wow, only 20 more to go.
Okay.
Trying to be quick.
Mr. Pinkerton?
So yeah,
9.03.
So this is the energy services contract. So Mr. Plaza kind of went over the details of working with Tome Electric. So, you know, this is something the board is familiar with. We're systematically using Prop 39 funds to go through our district and replace all of our lighting, you know, using those funds. In this case with Loam's, we were able to get that extra grant to help pay for it, which is fantastic. So this is really every single inside-outside light at Los Osos Middle School. And we'll proceed to go to Laguna next, to the other elementaries, as we move forward in utilizing those Prop 39 funds. It's a huge benefit for us because long-term, lower energy costs means lower bills, which means more money in our general fund. So it is a huge plus for us to do these retrofits. So this is just the process of getting that accomplished is to have this resolution tonight and have the board accept it.
Is there Mrs. Shepherd? Did you have a comment? No. Mrs. Roger.
Well, I remember we had discussed at Los Osos Middle School that ultimately we would be, I can't remember exactly the verbiage, but it was something like zero net energy
is the grant, yes.
So not replacing the fluorescence in the portables, will that affect our zero net energy possibilities?
If you'll take the short answer of no.
Sure, I'll take it.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bachman, yes.
Thanks, guys. So I appreciate that the fluorescence in the portables maybe won't take us beyond zero net, and we're going to leave them in there. From what I understand from what you've told us in the past, the fluorescence cycle, just like the computer screen cycles, and it's sometimes distracting to students. So ultimately, will we be able to just change those bulbs as they die out? Because they now make LED fluorescent tubes.
Yeah, we'll look at actually retrofitting those eventually. It's just as part of this, it wasn't kind of part of the initial assessment and everything else. And so we've kind of just segregated that off, if you will. But again, those fixtures are fairly new and relatively modern. So we don't have these similar issues of the old T8s and T12s. We haven't gotten any complaints in that space that I'm aware of.
And is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Seeing no one. Mr. Buckman?
Thanks. I'll make a motion to approve item 2.06, number 34-16-17.
And I'll second.
So we have a motion by Mr. Buckman and a second by Mrs. Roger.
Mr. Buckman?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you. Item number 10.01 is the public hearing and first reading of the proposed 2017-2018 budget. And we will first open a public hearing. Is there anyone from the public who would like to comment prior to our staff presentation? Seeing no one?
Is this the public comment period for this?
We can't comment after? For this item, this is the opportunity for a public comment. If you'd like to make a comment, would you like to come to the podium? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you from back there. Judy.
Judy Neuhauser. I'm not exactly sure how we're supposed to comment on the budget when we haven't heard the budget presented. And so I would like the opportunity to comment after the budget has been presented. Thank you.
Mr. Pinkerton.
So I think that was part of the I think that's staff gives presentation, board asks questions, and then we're going to have open up to public comment at that
yes.
point. Yes, so there will be another opportunity. So Julie's going to come up right now, going to talk about, give the kind of the public presentation. Since this is kind of a formal public hearing, that's why it's a little different in terms of the opening and opening it up to the public. So so the hearing is now open.
Good evening. Tonight is the public hearing for our 17-18 budget, and we're also going to go over our 16-17 estimated actuals, which we do with every budget. And first I'm going to go over the estimated actuals just briefly. This is almost, I'm sorry? The PowerPoint, I'm sorry. The estimated actuals is almost like a third interim. We go through our budget in the current year, and we budget what we think is really going to happen we look at our revenues and budget if we've received more revenues. We look at our expenses and take things out that we don't think we're going to spend. And as you can see, in our official estimated actuals as of May 5th, it looks like with taking into consideration the estimated revenues and estimated expenses, we're going to have about a $3 million deficit, and our ending balance is going to be about $14.7 million. Now, after we do this official, we look at it again, and we say, okay, well, we're going to have, I think, quite a lot of deferred revenue this year. There's a lot of programs where we've received revenue for these programs, and we're not going to be spending it until next year. So we looked at that, and we decided that our estimated revenues are going to be closer to $91 million instead of $92.4. And same with the estimated expenses. A lot of those are going to carry over to next year, where we haven't been spending them down for various reasons. And we'll be spending them instead next year. So we reduced our expenses to about $93 million, which means our deficit is down about $1 million from a deficit of $3 million to $2 million, and our estimated ending balance would be about $15.7 million instead of $14.7 million. Now keep in mind that out of that ending balance, we're going to be budgeting some of those again next year because they're in restricted programs, and they have to be budgeted back in those restricted programs. And so in the 17-18 budget, some of the assumptions that we used for this budget is we put in a 3.5% property tax increase. We also took into consideration the depreciation from the Diablo power plant. We did not budget anything for the PG&E settlement at this time, although when Ryan goes over the 10-year, we do have it in the 10-year projected budget because the 10-year budget differs from our official multi-year projection in that we use that to project what we really think is going to happen. We look at our revenues and we think, okay, we probably are going to get this revenue. And we look at our expenses and we look at historical averages and put in what we really think we're going to spend in that. So it's sort of an internal projection for us. Our one-time mandated cost reimbursement, Ryan mentioned, the governor's budget had it in at $48 per ADA, and that's what we budgeted. And then last week, the governor's May revise about tripled that, which was great news. And then yesterday, school services came out with a report, and I think the way I read it was that that's not due to be released until May of 2019. Yeah, not even next year. So they said, don't budget it. It's too uncertain. Don't budget it in the future. Don't budget it now. We'll see what happens. So we'll have to take that out of the budget. And we may bring that back as a 45-day revise when we do our unaudited actuals, and you can see that taken out of the budget at that time. MA revenues have been coming in pretty steadily, so we budgeted that at $150,000. As usual, we don't budget for donations or billing accounts. We will be moving deferred revenues when we know what our ending balances are. Special ed revenues are based on county office estimates that they give us. And we have no transfers between Fund 20 and the general fund, either in or out, for next year. And Fund 20 is our other post-employment benefit fund. And we will have another actuarial for that done next fall as well. So we'll see what our new unfunded liability is.
Do you want to wait till questions?
Sorry?
Can I ask a question at this point? Do you mind?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so in Fund 20, we often, at least if I remember correctly, last year it was a $950,000, nearly $1 million that was moved over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at this, and it looks like we're about $1 million. We're going to come about $1 million short. And so I'm wondering about the choice not to borrow against Fund 20.
So I think our focus in developing the budget, looking at the 10-year, was we've been using Fund 20 to actually pay down some of our debt over the past years. We want to stop that. So we want to stop using Fund 20 to kind of help with our general fund. So it's kind of a yin and yang where we're not going to put any money in, but we're not going to take any out. So kind of leaving it the way where it's at currently. And what I would say with the board is if we do receive the PG&E settlement, if we do have extra funds, we should build that back up. So that's kind of, you know, it's both in and out. We're looking at, you know, no general fund transfers, not using that to help our, you know, our normal costs throughout the year.
Okay.
Mr. Unger.
Do we expect that our Medi-Cal reimbursements would diminish significantly if Trump Care passes through the Senate?
I think that remains to be seen. I haven't heard anyone talk about that, but and I'm kind of surprised I haven't, but I would assume that if it does get passed, that, yeah, that would definitely reduce or eliminate that. It sounds like it. But I haven't heard anything from school services or anyone else talking about that at this point. I think there's too much that's unknown yet. You can see from our graph, unless there's any other questions, no, that our property taxes are the vast majority of our revenues. They come in at about 80% of all of our revenues. The other LCFF revenue includes the categorical funds that we get, the Education Protection Act money that we get as a basic aid district, the transfer that we make to the Adult Ed Fund, the payment to the charter school that we make, and the special ed property taxes, and that came in at about 6% of our revenues. Federal revenues are about 3%. State revenues are actually about 7%, but you can see 4% of that is that STRS on behalf money, which is really just on paper. It's not true revenue. It's just a shuffling of funds to show what the state owes STRS. And local revenues come in at about 4% of our total revenues. And in the expenditure side, as usual, we put in step and column increases for everybody and the 1% negotiated increase for cost of living. Our STRS rates are up from 12.58% to 14.43%, and PERS rates are up from 13.89 to 15.53%. I don't know if you looked at the narrative, but we did a little bit of a projection on all the benefit rates to see where we started and where we're going to end up, and it is dramatic, to say the least. Health and welfare is budgeted with a 6% increase. We will look at that after open enrollment because people change plans, so that could change. And last year, or this year, forget which year I'm in, was the last year we had to make a payment on the retirement incentive that we offered in 2011-12, so we didn't have to budget for that next year. So that was a savings of about $376,000. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you very much. So, Julie, as we look at the capital outlay, last year we budgeted, I don't know, $15,000, and I think it was second interim, it came in at about $1.3 million. So my concern is it looks like we're going to budget about the same amount again, and I'm just worried that, or just an explanation, do you think we're going to end up with 1.3 at second interim?
In equipment? I don't think it'll be that much. Do you want to address this, sir?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, in terms of looking at the overall budget and the bottom line tonight, is that without the PG&E money, we're about $1 million in deficit right now. So as of today, if we do not receive the PG&E money, we have about $1 million deficit. So if we receive the PG&E money, which all indications are things are good, PUC is moving through, we should know that in October, right, when we find out about our property taxes, we could actually have $1 million surplus, which the 10-year budget, which I'll talk about, outlines. So it's one where this is probably a year where as we go through reductions, we made all these district office cuts, we're probably not going to buy any buses or new vehicles this year. So it's kind of a conscious choice just to not have it at this point, you know, until we see what the, you know, kind of where property taxes land, those types of things. So in the past, that's what we've kind of done. We've waited until we see kind of did property taxes come in as expected, then we add those items if we can. This year in particular, I would say that we've made kind of a conscious choice not to fund that.
I would just remind people who might be listening or watching that if we do get the PG&E settlement, that's all one-time money.
Yes, which I'll outline when I talk about the 10-year.
Okay. So we also have the superintendent's recommended reductions are included in this budget. As we said here, there's nothing budgeted right now for equipment, vehicle replacement, no transfer to Fund 20. We always budget our site allocations a little bit lower because we don't know what our seabeds is going to come in. So we budget 90% of last year's seabeds until we know this year's, and then we budget them at 100% of their seabeds per student allocation. The LCAP expenses have been budgeted, and we'll go over that in just a minute. And, of course, we'll budget our carryover amounts after we know what they are when we close the books. I tried to find some quotes on budgeting that I thought would be inspirational, and I can tell you I found two, and this was one of them. The budget is not just a collection of numbers, but an expression of our values and aspirations, and that was Jacob Liu that said that. And so here are our values. We value our people. Our people, our salary and benefits are about 86% of our revenues, which is right about where we want them to be. You can see that this year our employee benefits alone are about 21% of our estimated budgeted expenses. Last year they were at about 19.1%, so those benefits are taking up a bigger and bigger piece of that pie as every year. We have books and supplies at about 5, operating expenses at about 8, and then other outgoing transfers out are about 1%. And those will all change when we get our carryover amounts in there, too. We try to keep our LCAP budget in certain codes so we can identify those costs. And they're actually, I failed to change that, they're actually in discretionary codes 3910 through 3950 this year because we eliminated one of the LCAP codes. And you can see that we have a total budgeted of about $7.2 million in the LCAP. Of that amount, we have about $4.9 million budgeted for supplemental costs, and those are the costs associated with EL, low socioeconomic, and foster homeless youth. And we also budget the supplemental in a separate resource so we can track those expenses separately as well. excuse me. This graph just shows the difference between our property taxes, our LCF revenues, and what our LCFF revenues would be if we were an LCFF district. And you can see that from about this year on, we're projecting that our property taxes are going to increase at about the same rate as those LCFF revenues. So we'll probably stay in basic aid status for the next few years at least. And this is something we're required to present. Ed Code 42127 requires that we identify the minimum recommended reserve for economic uncertainties, which is 3% of our budgeted expenditures, which is about $2.7 million. Anything over that, we have to identify. So the list here includes everything that we have as assigned balances as part of our ending fund balance, and that amounts to about $9.9 million. And then this was the only other quote I found that wasn't technical, and it's clearly a budget. It's got a lot of numbers in it. And now Ryan is going to go over a lot of numbers with you.
Thank you, Mrs. Lang.
Yeah. So kind of big picture types of things. The reason why I gave you a copy of the 10-year budget is because you can't read this, right? So hopefully that is of assistance. But so big picture things I would say for the board. We faced our first loss of unitary tax this school year. So that hit our bottom line this year in terms of ongoing revenue sources. So when that happened, we went out and we did a study with school services help. What is our LCFF? Are we going to fall out of basic aid? Or are we going to stay basic aid? Very huge. That's a big deal for us because the extra money we receive and where we land. So that's what this. Why we went from a 7-year budget to a 10-year budget. Because that now encompasses the 9 years of the loss of unitary tax. The whole top part of that under the revenue section does a comparison of our basic aid status, property taxes, versus what we would receive as LCFF. That number, or as Julie pointed out, is diminishing somewhat, but yet it still looks like over time, as long as the economy keeps up, property values maintain, at least some type of increase over time, that we should stay in basic aid status. So that's one. It's a good thing. It helps us in terms of budgetary. We tried to keep the cuts in terms of for this year and with our LCAP away from the classroom as much as possible. So the board approved, $2 million worth of cuts that do affect the classroom in some ways and do affect school sites, but overall we're more district level, I would say. And so purposefully, you know, class sizes are still low throughout the district. We haven't, you know, really looked at that. So when I was in charge, Dr. Prater put me in charge of enrollment this year and looking at class size of teachers and working with principals, because, again, personnel costs is our budget. And if we don't control personnel costs, we will be in a lot of trouble in terms of ongoing. So we have to manage that. We have to make sure that we're kind of moving in the right direction. But we weren't ready to jump into the increased class sizes. You know, no, we have a whole kind of plan for the Blue Ribbon Committee, reaching out to the public, working with the board on setting kind of what's the next stage of where we're going to head. But make no mistake, it will be personnel costs.
Can I?
Long term. In terms of what we need to reduce as we go. And mainly, the main reason for that is the pension increases. Right. So STRS and PERS, I think if you look at the 10-year budget expenditures, it's like $1 million a year increase. With the same people, that's not changing anything. We're going to have millions of dollars worth of increases. So the only way that we can handle those increased expenditures is going to be to look at some other personnel costs to take back, right? Because we, again, though we haven't looked at buying buses or cars or things for this year or equipment or, you know, that has to be part of our ongoing maintenance, our ongoing kind of look. So this budget, with the projection, the 10-year projection, we try to be as open and honest as possible. So we did put the $2 million, if you look at the bottom of the revenue section, it has the Diablo Canyon Power Plant settlement. $2 million for the first 5 years is in that budget, and we still have those deficits in out years. While next year looks okay, if we receive those funds, in out because of the STRS and PERS and increase in the health benefits, we quickly go right back to deficits, even with a 3.5% increase in property taxes projected, which will be way more than our state-funded districts will receive during those same years. So you can imagine what state-funded districts are going to have to go through as we move forward, and those they have to deal with those same costs that we're looking at. There is a kind of a catastrophe that's going to happen in education over the next two, three years, I guarantee you, if nothing is done. So I think the projection kind of gives the board a little bit of the crystal ball. It's not perfect each year on audited actuals. We put the real numbers in. So last year we had a $1.8 million surplus. This year we're looking at about a $2 million deficit. We have balanced budget over the past 2 years overall. That's the, you know, kind of the picture, despite the increases in STRS and PERS that we faced over the past few years. So we're in the right direction. We're headed down. It would be way better for me in terms of a business person to be way more conservative, to make way more cuts this first year so that we're not looking at those out-year deficits. But we realize as an organization, as schools, as the community, we have to kind of, you know, we slowed it down a little bit. But make no mistake, we're going to have to still deal with those ongoing increases in the future. So that's something we'll come back to the board, we'll share. The more updated knowledge we can get in terms of our revenues as well as our expenditures, we'll do that. We have purposefully in the LCAP this year been way more detailed in terms of position, what's in it, what's there. I mean, really important, because those are the extra things we do for kids. And that $4.9 million that represents supplemental funds, we have to have that money we have to have that LCAP. We have to have those funds, even while we make cuts, even while we deal with what we're going to deal with over the next few years. That will always be there. We will always have some services that are for kids in that plan. So it's going to be really critical that we know what that plan is, and the board can look at it and tie it to academic achievement, what kids are doing, and how it's helping kids. So we really wanted to be more detailed. I believe Ms. Sheffer last board meeting asked the question, hey, can we afford this? Right, all these great things that we're talking about. So it's in the plan. But we do have a structural deficit of about $1 million. If property taxes come at 3.5, depending on what happens with this one-time money, deferred money, we'll see what happens, you know, with the governor and the overall budget. I have talked to staff about kind of putting together a list of items that maybe we can, you know, look at again in October, should for some reason those PG&E settlement dollars not come through. So that's something we're going to have to be, you know, ready to deal with, I would think, you know, even for this year, if there's some one-time things we can cut back on. But again, structural deficit-wise, that PG&E money is one-time money that's helping us. It jumps to $4 million in those out years that you'll see. And what you're going to see next year, because we'll take off this, you know, last year, we'll add another year on, is the $4 million goes away. That goes to zero. So when you see the structural deficit of $2 million at the end of this chart, it's really another $4 million in out years. So the importance of establishing our foundation, the importance of looking at kind of what we're doing. We hopefully, those Diablo Canyon settlement dollars are going to give us a little bit of a runway to deal with this and kind of do it in a, you know, in a manner that takes everybody's opinions in and tie in and gives the board a chance to do it. But it's, you know, we're faced with higher costs and less revenue. And that's what we have to deal with. And we're still better off than most. So keeping that in perspective, I think, as we move forward is important. So that's kind of the budget synopsis. We can answer any other questions the board has in terms of the budget.
Yeah, so
I get to be somber for the next 9 years. It's great.
Yeah, I'm going to speak really fast. So.
Yeah, sorry.
Title I, Title II, Title III, Perkins, homeless, special ed, these are all on the revenue side.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going down. So these are, Trump and Betty DeVos have talked about a 10% cut across the board. Is that, these are all federal programs. Is that what we're seeing?
So again, this is a projection from what we know, what we've received in the past. So as we get new information, we change the projection. So we change it, you know, every time we do a budget update with the board, we change the numbers as we kind of know. So, you know, In 3 years, if Trump is gone, are we going to have a new Democratic president? The changes, you know, we can only kind of work with what we know, I would say. So, again, it is projection, and it can change, like the MA funds, like Mr. Unger said. Okay. You know, if that happens, we'll have to adjust and deal with it.
So these actually go down in fairly sizable amounts. So they're even, some of them are more than Title III.
Part of that is because the budgeted amounts don't include carryover. So once we know, we probably will not spend all of our Title I funds this year. Part of that's going to be deferred to next year, and then that will increase that.
There's one other that's a rather big dive. So when we get down where it's local, and then we go down to other local revenues, mm-hmm. we go from $2.1 million to basically $900,000. And that just seemed like a very large drop to me.
Sorry.
Or it would be in my checking account.
It is a large drop, and it's due to a lot of different things. The billing accounts is about $700,000 right now, so we haven't budgeted that yet for next year. There's other local revenues that we haven't budgeted. We got about $300,000 from insurance for the high school fire that came in this year. So there's all kinds of different things that play into that, and it's it probably won't go up this high next year. I mean, in a way, we kind of hope we don't get insurance money again. But it will go up throughout the year as we budget.
Mm-hmm. At this time, is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Mrs. Neuhauser, as you make your way to the podium, let me just reiterate what Mr. Pinkerton said, which is this is a slightly different procedure than we use because this is a hearing. And so Mrs. Holmes will be writing down your question, and it will be answered by Dr. Prater on the website. Okay, so.
Great. That's great. I'm not exactly sure what belongs in this discussion and what belongs in the LEA and what belongs in the LCAP. So I may repeat what I say if it's in the wrong spot. I was curious about what you said about Title I funds. And so I don't know if this is the time to talk about where Title I funds go, how they're accumulated and how they're dispersed. Is this the proper time or is it better under LCAP? Okay, I will wait until then. I'm just curious. We had talked about the last meeting. We talked about the budget that had been recommended, the $2 million
decrease in the superintendent's budget. And it, when I went back and looked at the file from February, it said that the secondary director of instruction would be combined, consolidated with IST. And what happened at the last meeting is you approved an IST director. And so I don't quite understand how that is the same thing. I kind of look at, we lost the assistant superintendent. I'm assuming Kimberly McGrath moved into that position, so then we lost Kimberly McGrath. But I have never been able to find an IST director on the website, so who was the IST director? Or did we not have one? So if you're talking about consolidating Kim McGrath with the IST for a savings of $81,000, how does that work if there was nobody in that position and you're simply hiring a director? So I would appreciate please unconfuse me. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to speak to this matter? Seeing no one, we will officially close.
Yeah, we close the public hearing. This, of course, will come back to the board at the next at the next board meeting for approval. Okay?
Thank you very much. Now we have item number 10.02. Which is the public hearing and first reading of the 2017-2018 Local Control Accountability Plan, or LCAP. Hello, Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. All districts in California are required to develop a local control accountability plan, which we call LCAP, and this does combine our educational plan with a portion of the district's budget, as Julie and Ryan just explained. The LCAP describes how efforts in eight state priority areas are being addressed and tied to student outcomes supported by appropriate resources. The LCAP overview provides a simplified view of the district's focus areas based on the plan. As you well know, we've discussed that overview and the six focus areas in our last few meetings. The LCAP must describe school district goals and specific actions to achieve those goals for all pupils, especially including our identified subgroups, as Julie mentioned, for each of the state priorities and any locally identified priorities. So for the LCAP for 17-18, it has five sections. These sections are a 2017 through 2020 plan. This is a three-year plan. You will see the first year of the plan detailed in our LEA plan addendum in the next item. The second item it has is an annual update. It includes stakeholder engagement. Next is goals, actions, and services, as well as a demonstration of increased or improved services for our unduplicated pupils. Based on extensive feedback that we have discussed at previous meetings from stakeholder groups, including our secondary students, the LCAP was formed. On May 2nd, Mrs. Shields, Mrs. Frost, and I brought an overview of the document. Goals were adjusted based on your feedback. Some suggestions were made about ways to look for changes to goals related to technology, as well as some educational opportunities for parents around technology. The five focus areas we're looking at are, number one, students will achieve substantial academic gains through rigorous, relevant, and engaging instruction and curriculum. Our second focus area would be identified subgroups will achieve substantial academic gains through a multi-tiered system of support. Number three is an intentional culture of care. Number four, expanding technology, promoting innovation. And number five, strengthen the use of data in order to improve academic achievement. Questions related to the LCAP will be handled by Dr. Prater and posted on our website. And as I mentioned before, the next item on your agenda tonight is the LEA plan addendum, and the LEA plan specifically defines many of the LCAP goals. You'll find detailed descriptions of actions and expenditures within our next item. Happy to answer any questions and open for a comment.
So I'm
Mr. Buckman.
Yeah, thank you. So what I just heard is any questions will be answered by Dr. Prater. So shall I just address my question?
For the public.
Public. Okay, thanks. Thank you. I don't know if this is best to Amy or not, but parent involvement is, I think, focus area three. It just throughout the LCAP, which is just near and dear to my heart. Parent and public engagement is just great. I look through this, And we've had, I know in the past year we've had technology nights, math nights, literacy nights, tech trainings for parents, and I just think that's great. But when I looked through this and I added it up, there's $17,200 allocated for basically parent activities, parent engagement and trainings. That's out of a $7 million budget. So for me, and what's near to dear my heart, that just seems like a very low amount.
I think what we actually were brainstorming with principals today about the different ways that they educate parents. I think to Mr. Quisenberry's comment last time about how do we inform parents about changes within technology and how to utilize that and how it impacts their students and instruction. I think what you'll find is a lot of the ways that parents are involved, there's just not a cost to it. It's not that it's not happening, it's just that there's not a cost. So some of the examples that I saw were that it's discussed at back-to-school nights, that when we visit open houses, they'll show, students will be there demonstrating how they're using technology and utilizing that. Within newsletters, they'll highlight different technology uses that are happening. There was a few examples of at ELAC at one school, they had the parents log into their students' Google Classroom and utilize writing samples and things that, just as if they were students. There were other examples within when they're working with parents and sitting down within science nights and kind of embedded into other nights, and there's no cost to those things. So I think a lot of what you'll find, it's not necessarily a cost connected to it. Does it mean that it's not a value or that it's not happening?
Okay. So so we've done those pieces, and we've attracted sometimes, I don't want to say the same old suspects. That might be unclear, unkind. I mean, we get the PTAs, we get the school site councils, we get the ELACs and the boosters. So within the plans or within the discussions, was there some discussion of strategies to involve more parents? I did go to a math night, and there were probably over 50 folks in there, and it was just really heartening. But I'm just wondering if we're reaching out to those that aren't normally involved.
I think principals are open to discussions, and we're brainstorming with one another, and they were kind of igniting and excited about ideas that they had with one another. So I think that discussion will keep going, and people will look at how to best educate our parents and connect with them.
Mr. Unger.
On page 5, there's a term that I've never heard before. It's accountable talk. Can you tell me what accountable talk is, please?
Accountable talk is a phrase that we use for English learners, and really it doesn't need to be for English learners. It's for any of our students, and I'm going to give you my best impression of it, and I may have to have Dr. Prater give you a more formal description of this in his responses. To me, accountable talk means when students are talking in the classroom in a collaborative academic discussion, we want the talk that's coming from them not only to be related, but to be using academic vocabulary. We want to hold them accountable for staying on subject, using correct grammar, using the, as I said, the academic vocabulary. If we just assume they're having a good conversation over there, that's not good enough. We really want to know that they're using what we're teaching them.
Great. And then the other question I have is on page 50. We talk about increase the percentage of high school students who complete A to G curriculum. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about all three high schools?
It would mostly be our two comprehensive high schools. There are some courses available at Pacific Beach that are A to G approved, but often students that are there, it's a different focus for them, and it's not necessarily headed to a university straight after Pacific Beach. So for our two comprehensive high schools, we have a couple of different focus. One, you'll see A to G related to career technical education. So that's specific, and you remember on the new courses that came, right? We had a huge bulk of career technical education courses that we have received A to G approval on. So that is one push there. And then just overall, looking at all of our courses and analyzing, you know, are they A to G approved or not? And if they're not, can we do that? Does that overlap with Pacific Beach? Definitely. Are the courses there, algebra, geometry, are all those A to G approved? Of course. Yes.
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. So I'm also interested, on page 20, it talks about the number of students who participated in the STEAM program. And then there was this statement, the only students who did not participate in STEAM-aligned electives are those in interventions including special ed, ELL, AVID, leadership, and aid positions. And so I guess the one that jumped out at me was AVID. And is it true that AVID students are not participating in STEAM programs?
Yeah, I would need to get the exact schedule to better define it for you, but it is an issue at middle schools when you only have a certain number of electives to choose from, and when you choose band and leadership or AVID and, you know, then some of the other elective courses you're not having exposure to. So it's a choice, it's an option. The other thing we're looking at is how can STEAM-related items be integrated into just curriculum so that it's not just a separated elective that you choose to go to. So I think that's kind of the way to help blend it when you look at how do we integrate it within their regular day, and then also other offerings maybe outside of the day that could be, you know, robotics clubs and things that kids could also choose to go to.
Okay, and just two more questions really quick. Also on page 20, I was really excited to see this day, an increased portion of high school students will have earned industry-approved certificates and licenses. Can you give me an example of, like, just maybe one certificate or license?
So one of the things we're looking at within our career technical education pathways is as students increase their skills as they travel through the pathway, are there industry-specific certifications that they could receive as they finish a pathway? So, for example, let's say in industrial technology, maybe it's a Cisco certification when they finish so that they then have, an industry-recognized certificate that they could walk away with so that industry understands the level of curriculum that they achieved.
Okay. And just from my, and I may combine do this, but a lot of times we're saying 90% of 90% of parents or 90% of the people involved in a program, and for me, 90% of how many parents responded, 90%. So you did a survey and 90% said they love, I think it was Pacheco was one of them, and I don't question that. It's just I question whether how many people responded to the survey. So 90% of 50 or 90% of the 700 that attend.
Right.
So just I think I'll stop by and do that, but just a question for me when I read this stuff.
Right. Good point.
Thank you.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? This would be the time for the LCAP questions. That's okay. And just again to clarify that anything that you say we're going to write down, and Dr. Prater will answer that, and it will appear like the budget on the website under the icon for LCAP prior to the June 6th meeting.
Great. Is this a time to talk about the LEA stuff, or I should leave that until the LEA? I'm just not sure what the proper procedure is. Will there also be formal response to the LEA? No. Okay. I wanted to follow up on one of the board questions, which was about the STEAM program. And what I read was that at Laguna Middle School, the AVID and the intervention classes were not involved in STEAM, but in Los Osos Middle School, every student was involved in STEAM. And so I guess part of me is wondering how the model at Los Osos Middle School can be used for the Laguna Middle School. So I think I'll wait for the rest of them when we get specific into the I actually have one question. There was something on one of the documents, and I honestly cannot tell you which of the three documents, where it was looking at site funding for K-6 middle school and then high school, and for the coast it was K-5 and then middle school was 6-8. And it went from 214 to 100 and something at middle school to then it went back up again higher at high school. And so I'm wondering what that site funding is or site-specific funding is and why it decreases at the middle school and why the sixth grade at the coast, every one of those students is getting at the lower one because they are at the middle school. So I want to hear about the equity of that. Thank you.
you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this matter? Seeing no one, we will close the open hearing for the LCAP. Sorry, I just almost lost my computer there. Okay, so now we're up to item number 10.03, and this is the LEA addendum first reading. Mrs. McGrath.
Yes, thank you. This is the first reading. No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 mandates that each LEA develop an LEA plan, and this is a one-year document. In San Luis Coastal Unified School District, the LEA plan addendum has become an important document for us, providing a more detailed description of our focus area goals, our action steps, and our budget for the upcoming school year. This document is tightly aligned to the LCAP and also to schools' single plan for student achievement. Throughout the school year, ideas for improving our district's educational programs are discussed through a variety of meetings with parents, with students, with community members, with teachers and administrators. And these discussions have informed our revisions and our creation of the LEA addendum. Included with each focus areas are specific actions. You'll find expenditures to meet each goal as well as metrics in order to review our progress and to check to see if we met the goals intended. LEAs are required to annually update the addendum. It must also be presented to the Board of Education for approval. Once approved, the document will be shared with principals, and we can begin enacting the actions. Tonight is just the first reading of that. Be happy to answer any questions.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this matter? Seeing no one. Oh, Mrs. Neuhauser, sorry.
So I'm going to come back to the equity issues that I talked about at the last board meeting on budgets. And one of them has to do with Title I funds, and one has to do with special funds that go to one particular elementary school in the district and to no others. I'm still concerned, and I'd like to hear it addressed, as to why the students on the coast who are sixth grade are not entitled to receive the services of those Title I funds because they have been moved to the middle school, unlike students at the Laguna Middle School in the city. Because a school site, even though they're using it mostly for lower elementary, my discovery when I taught at Monarch Grove was that we actually were using those funds. We had intervention the whole way up through sixth grade because they needed it. And so once those sixth grade students go to the middle school, their Title I funds are cut off because the Title I funds do not go to middle schools as per a decision made by the district many years ago. So I'd like that revisited and take a look at that equity for the coast students, because Los Osos Middle School has a higher percentage of low-income students than even Pacheco does. I also want to talk about, again, funding for that one school. And I understand, again, why it was determined that that school, as it began, needed extra funding to give it a kickstart. 20 years down the line, I don't understand it anymore. And I don't understand it as an equity issue for the other students in our district who are low income, as we have gotten more and more and more low income and EL students at other sites in the district. I do not understand how the district is justifying spending funds over and over again, year after year, on that particular school. I loved your comment, Mrs. Schaffer, when you talked about how these teachers were spending time being able to integrate all of their science in with their math and in with all that. The reason they do that is they get an extra $100,000 or more per year. Every school in the district would like that same opportunity. And I think you need to start talking about giving them that opportunity. I'd like to see the district start to talk about really boosting up their hands-on science. You know, the coast with the ocean, the Morro Bay National Estuary, the Elfin Forest, Sweet Springs has an incredible opportunity to become a real environmental education magnet school. And I would like to see funding to boost that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Neuhauser. Mrs. Shepherd.
I would just like to clarify, Mrs. Neuhauser, that when I made that comment, I was speaking about all of our elementary schools, not just Pacheco.
But that was during the Pacheco presentation.
Okay, but I mean it with regard to all of our schools.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Mrs. Roger?
Thank you.
There's no action required on this.
No, but I had some questions.
Oh, sure. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
As going through the LEA, initially the funding source for a number of items was listed as general, Title I, and various other things. But then as you move further through the document, you begin to see LCAP supplemental as the funding source. And I'd like an explanation of that and how it differs from general fund.
Mr. Pinkerton.
So it's all general fund, but we have to, so because of the LCFF and what amount we would receive in supplemental funds from the state, we have to allocate at least that amount. So we have purposefully, you know, kind of tracked those dollars, that $4.9 million, in those supplementary funds.
So you've just put that moniker on it.
So it's still general fund. It's all general fund dollars, but that moniker goes around those particular dollars.
Okay. That
because we have to, by state law, to show the increased services for kids.
Gotcha. It was confusing to me. Pardon me. And then the other thing that I noticed, and please don't ask me to find it again, this is quite a large document, but in going through, I noticed that the STEAM allocation for monies for Pacific Beach High School was, I considered it to be low. And I know that last year there was some indication they would be receiving a higher allocation of STEAM funding than they did ultimately receive. So I'd like some explanation of the STEAM monies for Pacific Beach.
Let me get to it. One second.
Yeah, I'm sorry I can't help you. There's just...
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, if you have found it, Mrs. McGrath, can you tell me where it is?
Page 28.
Okay.
Teamwork. Yeah, the
Thank
end,
you.
It would be kind of towards the end of Focus Area 4.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is materials and hourly time available for teachers at Pacific Beach High School to develop integrated units and lessons in order to do kind of what we were speaking about earlier. It is $4,000, and you're right, that's not a ton of money. And I think if we gave them more, they could absolutely do more with it. So I do think it, you know, it's a project that we were, you know, looking at. They were had some ideas. I don't think anything set in stone about ways that they wanted to utilize it, but it was they want to continue to integrate and to continue to develop lessons that engage kids and excite them related to STEAM.
I think they had some, I believe they had some interesting ideas for this academic year that they were not able to realize because they had inadequate funding. So I'm wondering how the $4,000 allocated to Pacific Beach compares to the STEAM funding allocated to our comprehensive high schools.
I don't believe we have specific, if I remember correctly, I don't think we have specific STEAM allocations for our comprehensive high schools.
So it's broken out into CTE courses and other ways. It would take a while to disaggregate that data from...
Yeah, I can't think of specific. You know, we have, for example, we have technology that's going to all three, and there's, you know, that kind of thing. But specific just STEAM related only to the comprehensive high schools, we haven't allocated it that way.
Okay. I would like to just go on record as saying that I consider that this is an inadequate allocation for STEAM education at Pacific Beach High School. Thank you, and I have no further questions.
Thanks.
I feel like an attorney. No further questions.
Are there any more questions from the board? Okay. And, well, I think that we have no action is required on this item. So thank you, Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you.
And we'll move on to item number 10.04, which is about our restorative programs. And Chris Dowler will be speaking, along with Assistant Principal Sean Alstott.
When I got here tonight, it was like a full house. And then I came back, and man, someone cleared out a room. But I'm grateful because I was really nervous. So anyways, I had been asked to talk about restorative justice. Restorative justice is a really big concept. It can take up conferences and seminars. So I'm really going to try to do everybody a favor and try to condense it into about 15 minutes or less. It's a promise. So restorative justice is a concept, and I really want to make that clear. It's not a prescribed program. It's just an idea. So I thought it would be useful to talk about this concept and this idea and then integrate it into how we're going to be kind of modifying our student discipline programs moving forward. So next slide. To give a little background, there's restorative justice in schools is a recent phenomenon, but the efforts to move schools away from utilizing suspensions and expulsions in student discipline is not. A big part of the reason why is that the state of California is really trying to move schools away from utilizing exclusionary discipline, suspensions, and expulsions is because of the disproportionate effect it has on minority youth. And this concept really goes back to about 2004. There was a body of research, a series of studies that were promoted by civil rights groups called the School to Prison Pipeline. And what it showed was is that students that had been suspended in school were exponentially more likely to end up in prison in adulthood. And furthermore, those same students were also exponentially more likely to be minority youth. So that movement, that body of research created a civil rights movement to change laws around the country around the utilization of suspension and expulsion. And the state of California was one of the first to react with AB 1729 in 2013, which basically is the first law in the state of California to really restrict schools' ability to suspend kids. So there's multifaceted parts of it, but it requires that we implement other means of correction, and it also restricts elementary schools from suspending kids for 48900K offenses in grades K through 3. 48900K is the defiance and disruption suspendable code. It was kind of the catch-all for school administrators. It was if you were going to suspend a kid for something and they were just tormenting people, you suspended them for K. But what the research showed is the vast majority of those kids were African-American youth and Hispanic youth. 2014, the Obama Administration Justice Department and Office for Civil Rights issued a Dear Colleagues letter. Again, those things are never as friendly as they sound. The Dear Colleagues letter basically said, we are going to investigate school districts that suspend disproportionately minority youth. And then in 2016, California's new LCFF-aligned accountability system has a very large component publicly reporting our suspension rates in schools. So this is all culminated to, you know, accountability for school districts in their suspension and expulsion rates. So next slide. How are schools reducing suspensions and expulsions? Some school districts, large school districts, basically took 48900K defiance and disruption out of their student information systems. You can literally not suspend students in their schools for defiance and disruption. So that is one way to reduce suspensions. Some school districts have implemented You can't even mechanically do it. Then there's positive behavior intervention systems. These are big programs that are very comprehensive, very data intensive, and very culturally shifting in schools. Restorative justice programs, I'm going to talk a lot more about that. And alternative means of correction are outlined in Education Code 48900.5. These are very prescriptive things that the state of California said you should do these instead of suspending kids unless they pose a danger to come back to your campus before you implement suspensions. We're really taking those last two frameworks and looking at our discipline models moving forward.
So what is restorative justice? Again, people make a lot of it. Like I said, conferences, seminars on the notion of restorative justice. But really, I found this sentence to boil it down into a nutshell perfectly. Restorative justice is any practice philosophically rooted in the belief that wrongdoing is best addressed through collectively identifying the harm done by one's actions and taking steps to repair that harm. Simple. So any practice that you implement that utilizes that philosophy is restorative justice. So moving to the next slide. Moved ahead of my notes. This slide shows the philosophical differences between restorative justice and traditional punitive discipline in schools. So traditional punitive discipline focuses on punishment to create deterrence from future actions, whereas restorative justice relies on helping students learn from their experience to teach them how to avoid committing that offense in the future. It's basically an instructional model as opposed to a punitive model. So those last three points, both the theory and practice of restorative justice, emphasize the importance of identifying harm, involving people to talk about the issue, and then helping the offender take true accountability, repairing the harm, and addressing the cause of the offense. If you can meet those three criteria, you've implemented a restorative justice program or process. Okay, next slide. To further conceptualize it, we're really big fans of triangles in education. They don't seem to be going away, so I'm just going to roll with it here. And basically, this triangle represents... Sorry, Eric. All right, thanks, man. This shows basically how different restorative justice programs might be implemented at different levels. So tier one would be community building. These are preventative, proactive programs at the classroom level that could be implemented to help prevent offenses from occurring. This is positive rapport building with students, circles, classroom discussions, training around positive language in schools. These are all basically tier one restorative models. Looking to restorative discipline. This is when a student creates an offense that is going to maybe have them be talked to by the teacher later or talked to by a counselor or an administrator or something that removes them from the classroom. So any restorative discipline could be things like mediated restorative dialogue with students with the school counselor or administrator. It could be an assignment to a restorative class where they receive curriculum on goal setting and life skill building and all of these sort of things. That's a restorative class. So those would be tier two interventions. Tier three is a very small subset of your student population, and this is restorative programs that are implemented after a student has been removed from school. So there is a place in the restorative justice model for a removal or a temporary exile or suspension from school. Hopefully, ideally, that's a very small number. Right? And so that would be things like a restorative justice panel that they would have to go through before returning back to the school. That would be things like counseling. That would be things like regularly scheduled check-ins with an adult mentor on campus. All of those are restorative concepts for students once they've returned to school from a suspension. But basically, between these three tiers, the concepts, the principles are all the same. Schools should build communities in which students should be able to repair the effects of their actions and learn from their experience before they're removed from the school, ideally. Okay, next one. How should we use the restorative justice to complement our current student discipline model? For the past year, I've been working collaboratively with secondary administration to utilize our other means of correction and restorative methods in our disciplinary practices. So these are the principles as we looked at revising our disciplinary procedures and aligning them from site to site. These are the three principles that guided our decision making and looking at how are we going to revise our disciplinary practices. One, student discipline should help students learn from their infractions. That's the first thing. Second, we should utilize every tool possible to address student discipline that could be restorative and punitive if needed. And three, we should not lose sight of the need to maintain student accountability and personal responsibility. So in looking at that, what we created, she's going to link to in a minute here, but it's basically a matrix. And this is a student, this is a discipline matrix aligning offenses and tiered different types of offenses. And so
It's a model which basically incorporates restorative measures and increases the level of intensity as disciplinary offenses increase in severity and frequency. So the goal is to reduce the use of suspension and expulsion to implement change in student behaviors. So on the left-hand side, what you have is you have, I kind of inverted the triangle so that tier one, the most common, least dangerous offenses are tier one offenses. And then we've labeled tier one response options. They're non-punitive options. They're very restorative in nature. Tier two offenses, yeah you can see it now. It really jumped off the screen at me. Tier two offenses are more serious. They may not inflict a certain amount of harm on someone. They could, and there's varied levels. So like things like mutual fighting or shoving. There's different levels of mutual fighting or shoving. There is the, you know, the two students who shove or bump shoulders in the hallway and they separate right away. Or, you know, then there's the kids who brawl and don't separate when they're told to separate. So there's different levels of that sort of thing. So we've built in the possibility to distinguish between those different type offenses. So there's some things that are repeated throughout the model. But tier two offenses, they're more intense. They've created some sort of harm, and then we've created a little bit more intensive offense response options on the right-hand side. And then tier three are the most serious offenses that do inflict harm on other individuals or create a significant safety issue at the school. So for those options, we still want to implement restorative measures when the students return to campus, but we've built in a model where we still utilize suspensions for those tier three offenses. Does that make sense? So I think the net effect of this, one, it aligns all our disciplinary practices between school sites. I mean, ultimately, individual administrator to administrator, there's going to be discretion in the way you deal with the problem, and all kids are different and they all need different solutions. But we have a menu to choose from that is common from school to school. We have programs that are going to be common to be able to implement from school to school. One of the big impacts of this is hopefully to reduce our expulsions, and one of the things to that measure is we've taken 48900C, which is under the influence for drugs or alcohol or possession of drugs and alcohol, and we have moved the expulsion for that from the second offense to potentially the third offense. So we've been very effective at reducing the amount of students that do end up on a second offense. But furthermore, we want to retain as many of those students as possible, potentially, and if they're able to engage in a restorative process. The next steps in looking at this moving forward is we need to train all our secondary administrators in restorative justice so that we share a common vocabulary. We need to create direct links to community organizations offering community service opportunities. And then we need to align our current documents to support restorative justice practices developed at each site. Marilyn?
Chris, going back, was it under the influence or possession?
Mm-hmm.
You were saying that it's being changed from a second offense
to potentially a third offense, correct.
But I thought second offense was Ed Code.
No.
Okay, so how much latitude then does the site administration have?
In a second offense? So what we're building in, there's quite a bit of latitude, actually. It's always been discretionary.
Could there be five offenses?
Hypothetically, there are school districts that do not expel kids for any drug or alcohol-related offense.
Okay.
They do something else instead of expelling them from school. So there's always been discretion built into that.
And then going back even further, when you had the food pyramid, the tiered
uh-huh.
thing, I saw that possession of a knife was a tier two offense, yet possession of a weapon was a tier three offense. Can you tell me what the distinction?
Sure. So it's not uncommon for us to find knives on campus that might be very small, not meet the Ed Code of knife.
Teeny weeny knife?
Yeah, a little tiny thing or something like that. There are times where students forget that they have knives. They were working on a ranch on the weekend. They had it for something they were doing outside of school. That's unrelated to it being a weapon. Now, that's a very different thing from a student bringing a knife to school and saying, I use this for self-defense when I'm walking home from school if I need
right.
to.
Right, okay.
They're very different disciplinary offenses. So I think part of the problem and what we're trying to move away from is the black and white definition of they brought a knife to school, we have to suspend them, we have
Any
to
knife.
Expel them.
Any
that zero tolerance sort of mentality I think was very unhealthy for schools and for kids. So we're trying to build in that discretionary framework into this model.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I thought I'd bring Sean. I mean, I'm very theoretical here. Sean is boots on the ground. He's the one who asked, you know, all of our schools are already implementing restorative measures in their disciplinary practices right now, but I thought it would be really helpful for you to get a direct idea from a guy who does this every day to talk about some of the things that he's utilized this year.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Well, thank you guys for having me. Chris did a great job of summing up what we've been talking about as a school district at our principals' meetings and different things like that. So I'm just going to share kind of anecdotally actually something we're going through right now. So we had a group of four students who were quote-unquote bored, and so they went and found a soccer goal to hang on and tip over and try and see if they could flip it around, essentially in the process breaking the corner, and now we're out of soccer goal. So in the old model, this is something that's a suspendable offense. We could have gone after these kids with punitive things and taught them their lesson in that way. But with the restorative approach, really the first goal is getting these students to understand how they impacted the school and the community. So with pretty much all four of these students, the first response was pretty defensive. Well, we were bored. We should have been more engaged at school or whatever it was. But through that conversation individually with each of them, they got to the point of understanding how they impacted the school, understanding the way they harmed the soccer coach, the way they harmed their PE teacher, and so on and so forth. So the next step was figuring out, okay, so how are we going to fix this? Because that's all about restoring the process, is not just saying, okay, you understand what you did wrong, now go about your day. It's, well, we still have a broken soccer goal on our hands. So these students got together, they brainstormed, they came up with a proposal. One of their parents was a welder. A couple of them are in the auto shop class that has, as you guys saw, a beautiful brand new auto shop. So they put together a proposal and they went to work, and on their own time they worked with the auto shop teacher to repair the goal. So I actually got to go out there today to look at it. The auto shop teacher vouched for it. The weld looks solid. It's got its perfect angles again. And these students, again, instead of just being suspended from school, these students now understand what they did wrong. They understand the people that impacted. They kind of got this hands-on learning experience on how to fix literally what they broke. So it's obviously not going to be that clean with every situation, but I think this is a perfect example of what we're going for with restorative justice, essentially. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Thanks. So that's the end of our presentation. So you have any questions?
I have a question, actually it's a comment, but I happen to be speaking to a gentleman today who does restorative justice programs at the colony, and one of the things they do, which is kind of a preventive measure, these men are there for to be rehabilitated, but I'm thinking, is there a way that we could integrate this piece of it in a preventive kind of way? So you don't know what student might be bored and go out that day and do something that wreak havoc. So perhaps if there was a way to work, I wonder if this is part of it, that students sometimes share things that have happened to them, like when they had a wallet stolen or their lunch was missing, or just that kind of sensitivity training maybe that could stick with students who might be thinking that maybe it isn't such a big deal, but maybe it is a big deal.
I think that would be next level. Right now we're looking at our reaction.
Sure.
But looking at that tier one level, I think is really needs to be filled in with better ideas about what to do in terms of social and emotional instruction for kids, common vocabulary shared amongst all the secondary staff, common philosophical alignment, and how we can build that level of sensitivity in amongst all students, I think that could be filled in a lot. I'm not there yet, but I think that that is something that we've really worked on in our middle schools with our restorative approaches training that we did for all the middle school teachers. A common, you know, they have a common understanding of positive rapport building with students and how to react when students do misbehave. But I think that preventative model of how to build in that level of community and trust in the classroom, that could be filled in a lot more.
Yeah, it's an excellent job that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris. That was great. So I have two questions. So in order to do the restorative justice as opposed to the expulsions and suspensions, is there a cost difference? Is there a cost benefit?
Well, if we were a revenue limit district, yeah, there's an obvious, you know, revenue based on ADA, you know, average daily attendance is built into it. In terms of like what we're looking at doing next year, we're not hiring like a coordinator, we're not hiring an outside consultant. We're trying to do this with our existing staff in-house and just by changing our model and our framework for dealing with discipline. So it's a no-cost proposal except for any training that we might receive so that we can, again, share a common philosophy and understanding.
Let me be more specific.
Sure.
So you personally get stuck with doing a lot of the, let's say, paperwork for the expulsions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the site is doing group meetings. And so is there any cost benefit to doing restorative justice in terms of staff time?
Well, ideally you build a better system of discipline where kids really understand their actions and they don't repeat offenses because they learned from the first one, ideally. I don't think there's much of a learning experience in suspension. Kids go home. Mm-hmm. And we're really, it's a system that's reliant on the family to support the suspension and implement their own disciplinary measures. But like something like 70% or 60-something percent of the kids we suspend are from socioeconomically disadvantaged families. I don't think you get that same desired effect. So they're much more likely to reoffend. Ideally, by building these programs more robustly or this response level more robustly, you're not dealing with as much repeat offense.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Quisenberry.
My understanding of restorative justice is part of the piece is that you actually have to confer, meet, confront, whatever, the person that has been harmed by your action.
Right.
And my question is probably for Mr. Allstott, if the young man in question had to talk to either the soccer coach, soccer team, or even the PE teacher.
Yeah, in this case, the PE teacher is the soccer coach, and all four of the students who were involved did approach that teacher and had a conversation with them and apologized for the situation. I think that is the model. Do we use that every single time? Not necessarily, but yeah, I think it's beneficial when that happens.
Yeah. Thank you for coming out to be with us and staying here so late. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item?
Judy Newhouser, Les Osos. I love this model. When I taught in a school in Costa Rica, which was one of my first teaching assignments, we used it starting in preschool. And I would encourage you to start working on possibly introducing this kind of process. I mean, children need to know that it's about how they affected the rest of their world. And, you know, it is a positive discipline. It is things that some of us teachers used quite a bit. The thing I would ask, though, is that if it is being used in elementary school, there needs to be somebody on campus who can actually help out with that. You know, Wednesdays the principals were gone. We shared a counselor with another school. The time that I was able to actually do this was when I had a student teacher. And I could leave the students with a student teacher with their lesson plan, and I could take those students outside and we could begin this process. But there needs to be a way to be able to directly address it. But I think if you train students up from TK, preschool, TK, kindergarten, on up through, by the time they get to middle school and high school, they understand the process pretty well. And hopefully it begins to have a preventative type of effect. So I'm really pleased to see you approaching it this way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Countywide, I will add, the County Office of Education is close to continuation schools in our area. So that, I mean, there is a cost savings long-term that's happening with this as kids are staying in school, and it's a positive thing all around. So it is making a difference. And across the county.
Thank you for adding that. That's awesome to know. I believe you're here because we're moving on.
Contract documents. Right. Here we go. So the board has passed the resolution selecting the lease-leaseback contractor. So the next step in this is we'll be bringing contract documents tonight. So what this includes, what you're voting on today, is basically, and we can go through each one, but there's contract documents, which includes all of the kind of payments, performance bond, workers' comp, prevailing wage, disabled veterans, so all kind of information about it. It has the facilities lease itself, which kind of breaks down kind of how the construction happens from the pre-construction services through construction, all the way through the improvements.
Are we going to approve each one of these documents individually?
No, not all those. So it would be 10.05 you would approve, the entire thing.
Okay.
So not each one. And hopefully, by going over it one time, you'll know that all of these same things are in the next five. So it has a calculator, which it talks, you know, it basically breaks down the overall cost structure of the lease payments, of the general conditions, as well as the maximum price it's set up. There's general conditions, which we talked about, is all of those things that leave after the construction is done, job trailer, supervisors. Special conditions that arise, asbestos, reporting, those types of things. And then lastly, the actual site lease itself. So the actual description and breakdown of the particular project. So each one of these has all of those documents. So the first contracts that we're asking you to approve tonight is basically San Luis Obispo High School, which includes the annex project, the new 12-classroom building, which used to be the old annex building itself, as well as the old gymnasium modernization.
And so, okay, so we're going to look for Mr. Quisenberry.
Oh, we have to go to the public on this first, don't we?
The public has left the building.
I know.
Anyone in the public who would like to address this item? Seeing no one, Mr. Quisenberry.
Well, I move for approval of the Measure D awarded contracts for the San Luis High complex, the annex building, and the old gym modernization. I think that covers it.
At San Luis Obispo High School.
At San Luis Obispo High.
10.05.
All the things listed in that.
Mr. Buckman, are you offering?
So I'd like to second that, but I have a question maybe for Kim. I think we've all read these and are pretty familiar with them. Mm-hmm. And unless there's a difference, is there any reason we can't just approve them?
If you would like to take one vote to approve items 10.05 through 10.09, or just eight, the way we did the resolutions, that's fine.
Okay.
I'll accept that as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Millar?
Just a comment. If we're going to put us through this torture again, why don't we do it at a Measure D meeting after we've talked about all this stuff, instead of jamming it into an already crowded docket and asking us to approve a whole series of complicated documents in one swell swoop, as they say. Just a suggestion.
Good. We haven't been approving things in our Measure D study sessions. They've been more just kind of informal, talking about things, items, not having public approval. So, but if that's something we want to move to in the future, we can do that.
We're going to be doing more of this practice.
What's that?
We'll be approving more.
There will be more contract documents in the future, absolutely. The resolutions, that's all going to be passed. So now it's basically these contracts that you see in front of you. We'll be bringing those forward for the other projects at San Luis Obispo High and Moorbank.
So it'll be a little more streamlined.
Yes.
In the future.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to say, Marilyn?
No.
Okay. Okay, so we have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry and a second by Mr. Buckman.
So that was just for San Luis Obispo High School. So the other projects that are tied in with these leaseback include at Morro Bay High School, the J-Wing building. So do we want to just
vote
on each one
individually? I accepted a friendly amendment from Mr. Buckman just to make it clear that it would be items 10.05, 10.06, 10.07, and 10.08. Is that correct? That's correct.
And those are the same projects that you passed the resolution on earlier.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry, a second by Mr. Buckman on the amended proposal on the table. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
All opposed? One. That's so 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, Ms. Sheffer, I did not hear, but you were. That was an aye. Okay. Okay, so that's 6 in favor and 1 opposed. And moving on.
So the last one was a fire alarm bid for Teach Elementary School. This was actually a design bid build project. So the bids are basically outlined there. They came in after meeting with the low bid in this case, Electrocaf, you know, very different than our leaseback. We are recommending awarding the bid to the lowest responsive bidder, which is Electrocaf tonight.
Okay, I'll move approval of item 10.09.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Seeing no one?
I'll second.
Okay, thank you. There's a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. And we're moving on to the action consent item. Item number, please tell me if you'd like to pull any of these items. Items number 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel. 11.02, approval of tentative agreement with SEIU. Item 11.03, disposition of surplus property. Item 11.04, acceptance of donations. And item 11.05, approval of field study trip requests, San Luis Obispo High School Skills USA to Louisville, Kentucky. So I'll entertain a motion. Mrs. Sheffer.
I'd move approval of items 11.01 through 11.05.
I'll second that.
There's a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 7-0. And we are ready for board reports.
Advance agenda.
Oh, is there? Okay. Advance agenda. Anyone have an advance agenda item? And moving on to board reports. Mrs. Roger?
Oh, I'm sorry. My light's on an error.
Mr. Quisenberry.
Just want to mention a couple of board walks. I did get to go to Laguna's Middle School Kitchen. Aaron led the tour. I got a chance to view meals being prepared and packaged for lunch that day. Tasted a very healthy dish created with whole grains, fresh and frozen ingredients. We discussed locally sourced fruits, vegetables, and grains. Got to look at some equipment, take a walk into their walk-in refrigerator. I was very impressed with the equipment, even though some of it's old. It's all very serviceable. And I also had a chance to visit Bishop's Peak Elementary, and Dan Block let us visit classrooms. I believe Ellen was with me. Ellen's not paying attention. Okay. And we saw a whole range of classes, and it was a very productive boardwalk.
Thank you, Mr. Quisenberry. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, and I had a chance to go to Morro Bay High School and see the balloon drop with Mr. Rapucci.
Oh, good.
It was great. So just the balloon drop is a science experiment that involves a weather balloon that goes about 250 or 300 feet. The students attach science experiments to it, and then they test what happens when you, say, drop them. It's a great project. Look for the students to be interviewed in pictures in the Bay News.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Unger. And Mr. Buckman.
CSBA Region 9 Director Tammy Gunther and myself as the rep have, I think, for a long time been trying to get CSBA to come to our part of the woods and do some trainings. We were able to do that. It was well attended by other school board members from around the county. And hopefully they'll be coming back and doing more trainings. I was at Pacheco on a Saturday, and the custodian, Richard Johnson, was there combating an infestation of pigeons. and was doing some rather ingenious work, so shout out to Richard. I got to attend the Morro Bay Car Show with... What?
Well, she's laughing about penguins.
Pigeon infestation. Yes.
Just say squab tonight.
Squab tonight. We're all good. They had squab at Pacheco for lunch.
Locally sourced.
I'm sorry. I got to attend the Morro Bay Car Show with I think almost the entire board or the entire board, which was phenomenal. I have to say I was particularly interested that two of the presenters at the show were Anthony Palazzo and Steve Stewart. One has a Chevy, one has a Ford. They were parked far enough apart that there was no fighting, so that was good. A shout out to several of the students who were helping direct traffic, Cole Visconti, Tanner Doherty, Nathan Morin, Justin Black, Keith Morrison, and Jonah Johnson, plus I think the entire class was pitching in, and it was just a great event. And then I went back to Morro Bay High School that evening and had a great Cinco de Mayo dinner, and C.L. Smith had a great carnival. Yeah, there you go. I didn't see it there, but it was good. And then I'm leaving Thursday for Sacramento to attend the California School Boards Association Delegate Assembly and staying through till Tuesday to lobby our elected officials with the Tri-County Education Coalition to get, well, I guess we're going to be talking about the May revise because it takes away quite a bit of money from public education. So, interesting times.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Buckman. And I believe that's it. I believe that's a wrap. So thank you. And good night.